So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Rivulubay.
I'm waiting. Like I know that one day there will be a day where I will have to delete my Twitter account. You know, but I know it will not be for saying something that dumb. But I know I'll do something really stupid on there and feel like I no longer deserve the privilege of being able to directly address people.
That's what people have like said. It's like within our lifetime, like there's going to be like forget our lifetime. Within the next like 5-10 years, like there's going to be like a presidential candidate or something who's going to be called to task for a tweet that they sent out.
Oh.
6 years ago.
Oh my gosh! No, it's gonna be like even worse than that. There's gonna be within our lifetime a presidential candidate who has a dick pic or boob shot on the internet.
Probably,
you know, because like there's like been a sexual revolution that just I'm you're a little younger than myself, so you might have seen it, but I it passed me by. But like the cell phone camera, the web camera, sexual revolution that happened where
yeah, I kind of missed that.
Me too.
Ourselves personally, I guess we did not.
You know, at the time,
dude, I would
hate have loved to have been there.
How much would you hate to be like 14 years old right now? I would fucking hate it, dude.
Oh my god, oh my god, I would have. The things I would have said even 10 years ago on Twitter would have. I put out a zine, right? Like I did a zine. I did 50 copies, you know, if that. You know, I barely did any copies of it. And I did a list of my favorite singers of all time. My number one favorite singer was this guy, Ian Stewart, from this band, Screwdriver. Mm-hmm. And I really put that in for, you know, like I really do like his voice, but he's very problematic because Screwdriver was a band on Chiswick Records, put out the first 101er single, pre-Clash band, put out the first Motorhead single, you know, put out like some R&B stuff, like R&B kind of punk stuff. But also, Screwdriver later breaks up, lead singer gets it back together, and they become a neo-Nazi band. Like the
I think you told me
they're like
this.
The Clash of neo-Nazi bands. Like they're like the big neo-Nazi band. But anyway, so I put them on my list, and I say like pre-Nazi only, blah blah blah. But it's stupid. I shouldn't have done it. I made 50 copies of this zine. Here I am, like 2 years ago. You know, I'm going to Iran as Conan does, and I'm reading on the internet. I'm listening to a Guardian podcast, like from the Guardian website, and all of a sudden it's like, you know, the singer fucked up, Bill Love, like this band, blah, blah, blah. Too bad the singer is a fan of Ian Stewart, the Nazi from Screwdriver, because he said he was his favorite singer of all time. And I'm like, holy shit, like, no, what, like, ah! So I had to write, like, oh, like
you're kind of calling me a Nazi right
now. Yeah, like, I'm like, write this huge explanation, like, well, no, that's not what I said. Also, I really regret saying that, you know? That being said, if that was on a blog, you know, like, it's like these weird things. Also, when I was on, like, Fox News said that I was going to be, like, the new on the show, or, like, not Fox News, sorry, Fox News never said that. The internet said that I was going to be on Fox News.
I remember when you did that.
I'm like, it still this day comes up. Like, people still will be like, you're an asshole and you work for Fox News. I'm like, no, that's not what happened. Like, I was a guest on this guy's show, and, like, yeah, he's got some horrible opinions. Horrible, horrible, unforgivable opinions that I really disagree with. But, you know, I was on his show because the Melvins had been on his show, and Andrew BK had been on his show, and all these people that I kind of was like, oh, I'm very vain and want to put myself in these people's category. But I did not want to be on there because of the politics. But anyway, it's still, like, haunts me this day.
I'm amazed at times as well. Maybe not amazed, but it's like, you can do so much stuff, and it's like something so trivial you do, that's what people know you as. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Like absolutely. Like until, you know, like I still, you know, have like vague associations with, yeah, even like with like, you know, people that, you know so far removed from something. But if you know one thing about them in their past, it's like I cannot get beyond that. Like, you know, I know that so-and-so was in a ska band. It's like, I know they were in a ska band. You know, I know they're in this cool, hip indie band now. And, like, everyone's like, awesome. But they were in a ska band. You know?
I love that. I imagine you about to bring up, you know, I know that you're racist or something. No, you were in a ska band. And you and me are just never going to sit down and agree on anything.
Because like, if you were like a Nazi, like a real Nazi, you know, chances are we can't really get past that. But if you were like a ska fan, we can get past that. But know that I know. You know that I know.
I'm going to keep all this in if you
don't. Yeah, well, I don't care. No, that's why I was like,
I like the preamble.
Oh, I love the preambles on your show. That's why, like, as soon as I come in here, I'm like, you know, I'm not going to say anything, like, you know, like, that could be taken out of context too much, because I'm like, I know the mics are going to be hot, so I don't want to say anything to you.
I will probably need to take a piss break at some point, as will you, so don't feel...
Actually, I'm a camel. I can hold...
Really?
Yeah, no, I'm a... I know from listening to the show that you do not have the same ability, but I for some reason... Actually, that being said...
Like, this size of drink, like, that's a piss at the end of it.
This size of drink, I can hold. Because wow. I'm used to, like, riding for hours in the van. Actually, the first time I went to L.A., we went on a school trip, right? It was the best school trip. Best thing I've ever... One of my favorite trips I've ever done.
This is high school?
Yeah, in high school. Oh, I hate traveling, but we had a media teacher, Mr. Orlando, that was friends with Johnny Ramone. So we go to L.A.
This sounds like a sitcom.
It's crazy. We go.
Our media teacher, Mr. Orlando, yeah. Hanging out with the Ramones.
So we go down there, and he's like, you know, here's your itinerary. And it's like first day, it's like dinner with Johnny Ramone, right? And I like, was busting his chops. Like, this is not going to happen, right? And so, sure enough, we go to L.A. for this media trip, right? Like, it's crazy. We're, like, in Los Angeles. We go to the hotel lobby of, like, the Holiday Inn we're staying at, just outside of, like, you know, one of the suburbs of L.A. type thing. And we're eating dinner there, and we're waiting. It's like 20 kids from my class or 30 kids from my class that went down there. And we're all just, like, sitting down there and waiting. And then sure enough, after dinner, we're just, like, making fun of Mr. Orlando that Johnny Ramone's not going to show. And in walks Johnny Ramone wearing, like, Elvis glasses.
Oh, my God, man.
With his wife, who's the KKK Took My Baby Away woman, the one that, like,
oh, wow.
The one that, like, divided Joey and Johnny years, and, like, he just sits down, and, like, no one really in my class. There was a couple kids, like, this friend of mine, Dave Harrons, a couple other kids that were into, like, punk, but, like, I was, like, the punk super fan, so basically it's just me just, like...
Holy shit.
Just chatting with him, and he said, like, a lot of stuff that, at the time, I didn't really appreciate, but now I do, like, as far as, like, what touring's like, and how... You know, you love traveling, but eventually, like, you go to these places, you don't get to see anything, you don't get to experience things, you just get to go to the venue, and it really, really grinds you down. And I'm like, what an idiot. Oh, that's not true. And then sure enough, here I am, like, oh, gosh, the same warehouse in the same suburb of the same European city, you know? Like, it's like, you never get to see, like, I've been to Paris... a dozen times now, right? Like, but I've been there once as a tourist. I saw more that one time as a tourist than I have the dozen times I've been there as a touring band member.
Oh, really?
You know, like, you don't get to see anything. But anyway, like, so...
16-year-old you to Johnny, what an idiot.
Yeah,
this
no, it's crazy.
Is.
No, and then he took me aside at the end. He's like, you know, do you or any of your friends do drugs?
Oh.
I'm like, no. He's like, good, stay away from me. You don't want to wind up like Dee Dee. And I'm like,
whoa.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, that's awesome.
Jesus.
You know, not to speak ill of the dead, but in both cases. But no, he was really cool. And then at the end, he's like, can I call my friend to come hang out with us? And we're like, yeah. And it's Sylvester Stallone's son, who was in the movie.
Oh, really?
Was in Rocky V.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Oh, the one who died like 2 years
Did
ago.
Did he die 2 years
Dude,
ago?
Dude, his kid died of a...
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's crazy. We all like hung. He was super nice.
Wow.
And he was also in, like, the one where Sylvester
It was, like, 1 year ago. It was right before the last Expendables came out. Yeah, apparently his son was, like, pretty much excommunicated and was, like, living in this hotel room. And he had told down, like, the receptionist, he's like, you don't let anyone into my room or shit. And he I think it was an overdose. And then they found him in there. Yeah, it was really messed up.
Have you ever
up.
Read that book, Everybody Loves Our Town? Have you heard of that book? It's like
no.
The oral history of grunge in Seattle. Amazing book. Hilarious.
Oh, maybe
stories.
I have heard of this.
Incredible anecdotes in it, but the Lane Stanley one. I bring this up
later
on it comes up on the pay-per-view. Lane Stanley at least does. It's just like he when he died, he was just like so screwed up that his like he had to get his like arms amputated apparently. And then he died and people were just robbing the house and leaving the body there for like
holy shit, man.
Yeah, it's like, whew. But anyway, he smelled like weed. Man, he didn't smell like heroin or anything.
What a start.
What did I do with my... Oh, there it is. Sorry, I'm going to grab my computer.
Okay, here.
Not that my notes compare to yours, but, you know, and I got a couple things I'd like to point out there.
Oh, well, I've got a solid 2,500 words here on the Great American Bash, 1999.
It's like an unbelievable pay-per-view.
Dude, watching
was
this?
Was there a legit, I don't want to spoil it.
Let's
But it's like an incredible moment in wrestling history.
Mike goes on, hey, Tank Abbott's backstage.
Tank Abbott,
choking Sting.
And there's Big Papa
Punk. What? Sting! Big Papa Pump turned the dogs loose on Sting!
Sting, that's it! Looks like the Doberman!
It's two Dobermans, Tony!
Early attacking Sting!
Look, look at that one, they're ripping his knee. Another one!
That's a Rottweiler! This was all planned! Oh no! Security is coming in! Oh, fans, we had to take the cameras off of Sting and go to security. Oh, my God.
They'll rip them apart.
Two Dobermans and a Rottweiler. Brutally attacking Sting. Tank Abbott. Scott Steiner. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I pray and hope that they pull these animals off Sting. They got to. This transcends a wrestling match. Pinfalls count anywhere. They've got the referee. The Steiners come out.
Don't make me call a dog. Oh, use my
gift. Oh, we got beat. I represent the 37.
You thugs and thugheads out there.
Get ready to ride it. Huh? Body, body. What is it? When the truth don't sell down. What is it? Same way. The no. What is that? What's up, Kimmy?
Jack for the summer. That's that sitting on Twitter, but I ain't no motherfuckers done. Grab a cat, where they at? Rat the tat cat. I represent the third. Are you a rookie? I'm a vet. You the captain, I'm the crunch. You got the dinner, I got lunch. Hit the weed, pass the blood.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock, and it is away waiting week here on the show.
We're actually the same person, like Pokeroo.
You guys are.
I used to be Pokeroo.
It's weird because now, like last year, we had you on for a show
I missed it. You were missing. I know, but that's the thing. I'm one of you. You know, we're all just the same person. It's just one guy in a room throwing his voice with a mic.
Well, I consider you now like part of the unofficial roster.
Oh, because, I really appreciate it.
Because when Wei wasn't around to do the show this week, Damian Abraham, first guy that came to mind.
Oh, I'd love to be. And you know what's crazy is like, because we had ran into each other on the street a couple weeks back, and we had talked about I was going to come in now that I'm off for a little bit and stuff. And,
and you and I proceeded to talk for about a half hour on Dundas.
Well, I had so many stories. I've got like there's so many people I could talk wrestling with. You know, so it's great to like run into someone that I can finally, you know, decompress myself of all these wrestling related anecdotes that I have for the last few months. But anyway, so we were talking. I said I was going to come in, and people have been tweeting me like, should go back in the law sometime, and I'm like, I'm going to come in. It's in the works. And then I literally tweeted some guy, it's in the works. And then you called me and hit me up and said,
it was really in the works.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, that works out perfectly. I didn't lie to this kid.
Now we're going to get to the Great American Bash, which let me be honest here. I just picked this show because it was like late 90s WCW. It could provide some interesting material. I remember that I ordered this pay-per-view when I was like 15 years old. Have not watched it since. Holy shit.
It's amazing.
We're going to get to this show, everyone. This might be a lengthy one.
Yeah, that's true, because I got stories. I got digressions. Well,
you got some stories for us, because since you were last on in January, yes, when we reviewed XPW,
yes,
man, you've been to Australia,
yep,
where you were touring with Fozzy.
Yep.
You've been to England.
Yep.
And where else am I missing?
I've been to, oh, gosh.
All of us.
All over Europe, places in America, couple places in Canada, a lot of places, but it's been fun. But
you are up right now.
Stuff.
I don't even know if you're aware of this. You're up for Now Magazine's best band right
now.
Oh,
really?
I voted for you on
thank
Saturday.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you.
What everyone
say,
should go over.
There's like three or four things that I've been on, and then subsequently met a lot of people at our shows that have been like, hey, I heard about you guys here, or I heard you on here. I knew about you guys, but I heard you on here. The Law is definitely like right up there. It was like Rebellion Festival, which is this crazy punk festival in England that's just really insane. It's like it is something out of a sci-fi movie, a punk rock sci-fi film. And the other one is like the best show on WFMU. But like The Law, people constantly come up to me, you know, and I met people all over the world that are Law fans. So shout out to everyone.
Who would think that we could find a crossover audience between The Law and Fucked Up?
Well, I think the thing is wrestling, and I've talked about it on the show before, but wrestling and punk rock do have such a really strong bond for years, you know, and I've met dudes like people in Explosions in the Sky, people in like Mind Eraser, like people, all sorts of bands that are all like love wrestling, you know, and it's a really, you know, like Danko Jones, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah. You've been on their podcast a number of times.
Oh, yeah, no, but he's like, here he is, and, like, you know, I'm at his house one time. We were friends, you know, we love punk and hardcore. I look down at his bookcase and I just see, like, you know, Flair DVDs and, like, you know, Superstar biography and, like, all this stuff that I'm just like, oh, amazing. Like, yeah, of course you love wrestling. That, like, makes complete sense when I see your show and stuff. So. You know, I really think that rock and wrestling, you know, like beyond Cyndi Lauper, there's a really strong, you know, bond. And beyond Master P, too.
Oh, well, Master P, a clear wedge between wrestling and music.
Yeah, no, but I've definitely, yeah, like it's been, Action Bronson, too.
That's true.
I had him on the wedge. He hates any wrestling that's new.
That's new.
Yeah, like I was going to go bring up WrestleMania. I had him on just before WrestleMania. And he's like, I hate any wrestling that's new. And
did I'm you? Like, oh, we had Pusha T here a couple of weeks ago.
I know. I didn't. I have. What is that interview been posted?
Wade didn't end up getting to interview him.
Oh.
Unfortunately, it was. He was doing his. Him and Fabulous were doing their whole media day out of here, and Wade was going to interview both of them, and I thought that was great. It was like Wade is perfect to interview these guys. Like first of all, Fabulous,
he knows
who was supposed to do WrestleMania one year with John Cena and do a wrap off.
Right, and then he dissed him.
Yeah, didn't show up. So then Cena came out and just cut a promo on him. Anyway, and then Pusha T is like a giant like NWA fan.
Yeah,
and as I mentioned, not just the musical group.
No,
actual NWA, which when wrestling fans hear
North Atlantic Wrestling Alliance,
they do not think of Dr. Dre. They think of Dr. Death. And so unfortunately, Wade did not get to interview either of them. But it's always cool to me when I can find people that are like. Are in different like industries that do have an appreciation for wrestling. Well, I find those things really cool.
Bronson was like, you know, and then I'm like, okay, what about Paul Bearer just died? Like, you know, what do you think about him? And he's like, oh, he's a legend. Like, I loved him. I loved watching him as a kid, blah, blah, blah. You know, and you know, here's a guy that definitely was like affected so much by wrestling as a kid that he still watches old wrestling, but it affects all his music today. He just released a song, Rockers.
Yeah, that's right.
Kick, Marty Jannetty, you know?
With Marty Jannetty in
Marty Jannetty gets a shout-out, you know? Finally, you know, Jannetty gets the shout-out, not Michaels.
Tell us a bit about the Australia tour with Fozzy, because I
know
you not only did a podcast with him, but you got to hang out with him a
bit. Yeah, we chilled a bit with – I got to say, like, but this time last year at WrestleMania, I was definitely like a punk. I was like punk. Screw Jericho, blah, blah, Fozzy, blah, blah.
Oh, boy.
I love Jericho now.
See, the key is, Damien, you've got to interact with these people.
I know.
And, boy, I think it's one-sided for you.
Oh, you know, it's one-sided, but also, like, I love Jericho as a wrestler, too. But, like, you know, I was like, oh, Punk and I got so much in common. But, like, man, Jericho's such an awesome chill dude. You've obviously interacted with him.
Oh, he's always been great.
Over the years.
Yeah.
So. But, yeah, like, a really kind of cool guy and, like, incredibly humble in music, you know, like rightfully so, you know, he knows his place in wrestling, you know, he is like one of the greatest of all time, you know, but when it comes to music, he is just really humble and really just like, you know, just appreciative of everything he's getting to experience, you know, which as like someone like me, you know, I'm the exact same way, you know, when it comes to getting to play these shows. So Danko Jones played this show with Fozzy and Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses band, like a sideshow, and I went there, and I got to meet, the first time I interacted with Jericho on the tour is Metallica threw a Welcome to Australia barbecue. It was this big, I guess I should start off by saying, it's this big festival tour with bands coming from, you know, all over the world to Australia and kind of going, playing like a, you know, a 50,000 person festival and then flying to another city. The gear kind of drives there over 2 or 3 days, and then you play another show. So you have these side shows on these off days where you play smaller club shows while you wait for all the gear to arrive for the festival show. And it's like, you know, when I say it's a big festival, it's ginormous. Like Metallica's there. I'm trying to remember some of the other huge bands. Blink 182 was on the tour. Like,
were you a Blink 182 fan ever?
You know what's crazy? Cheshire Cat, when that first came out, they did Snow Jam, which was like the winter Canadian Warp Tour, and it was happening at the Opera House. Now, Blink 182 didn't play the Opera House show, but I got a Snow Jam compilation sampler with a song of theirs on it, M&M's from Cheshire Cat, and I bought Cheshire Cat, and I love Cheshire Cat. And my brother, who was like a, you know, considerably younger than me, I think he would have been 11 at the time, used to just go to Blink-182 shows after that point because I played him that record and just hang out with the band.
Yeah.
You know, and now I think about how weird it would be if like an 11, 12, 13-year-old kid was just hanging out in our backstage, you know, especially as a dad.
Yeah,
I mean? Like, not that we're doing anything crazy back there or anything, but just like, what are you doing hanging out back here, kid?
I've really started to feel old lately because now, like, the generation where I grew up in, and you and I are pretty similar in age, yeah. But like late 90s, early 2000s, it's like that kind of segment of our history has now moved on to like slideshow material on Bleacher Report, like remember this shit in 2000, which at the time, I picture you being the kind of guy that thought it was just as lame as people maybe now look back at it.
I kind of did. I think by the time Blink started really blowing up, I've gone back and I actually like a lot of that Blink stuff that I wrote off.
I was a fan at the time. Yeah. Not like some crazy nut that would like pattern my clothing off of them, which a lot of people around me seem to do. But catchy tune. And when, as a fan of puns, when Take Off Your Pants and Jacket came out, I thought very clever.
They are.
You just hang your head, it's
Thank God there's wrestling, or I would never talk to this guy. I also think they are, like, back then, they were one of the best live bands I ever saw. On this tour, not so much. There were certain members of the band that definitely did not want to be there. And I heard they got, like, $1.5 million each.
Whoa!
For a show.
Or $1.5 million.
Yeah, there's, like, a big public spat because Travis Barker couldn't make the tour. Understandably so. He's not into flying, having survived a plane crash.
Doesn't make Master P's a price tag. Do you know what they paid this guy per appearance in WCW?
What did they pay him?
$200,000.
Really?
To not wrestle. To show up and sit.
Well, that's $1.5 million, though, for, you know, even like an hour of music.
But Master P was a bargain.
Wow, Master P. I bet you Master P, it's considerably less than that now to get a new public appearance.
Man.
You know, TNA could afford him.
Yeah.
CZW could afford him.
CZW might. I'm surprised Master P hasn't done the convention
An amazing show.
As well, you mentioned Australia as well. You had this crazy meeting with a documentarian in a gas station.
Yeah. Oh, no. I should finish telling the Jericho story. So anyway, So we did this interview with Jericho. Oh, so my first interaction story was the barbecue. I digress. This barbecue we did with Metallica through, where everyone got to come, all the bands. It was like bands and tour managers only. No crew, no friends, nothing. It was just meant to be like a real bonding experience for the bands, right? And it was like, it was weird. You know, anytime you get like a collection of bands that diverse together, it feels awkward.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Different worlds collide, different priorities collide and stuff. But, you know, we got a lot of friends that we got to see there.
That would be cool for you just to like be there and observe.
Well, that was the thing.
Interacts with who?
Yeah, and that was my thing. It was like, I'm like, I want to see like funny interactions. And sure enough, I look over and I see Scott Ian, Lars from Metallica, and Chris Jericho talking. And Jericho has his sunglasses on. Inside. So I kind of got a weird vibe. I got a weird vibe from him because I'm like, what's he like? And no, I think the thing is he was just like as taken aback later on, I realized, to be around these dudes as anyone was, right? But so I see Jericho and I never really liked metal. Like I didn't get into punk through metal. I got into it through like Sonic Youth and stuff. So I never really liked Metallica or Anthrax. I like Anthrax and Metallica now kind of like after the fact, but you know, I don't have any, like, nostalgic attachments to him. Chris Jericho, I am a huge fan of. So I kind of, like, look at this point, waltz over there and go, you know, mid-conversation, like, excuse me, Lars. And I'm like, Chris, Damien Abraham, huge fan. I'm really excited to be on this tour with you. And I'm like, oh, sorry, gentlemen, and just, like, walk off. And then, like, that was my first interaction with Chris Jericho. It's just like,
did you, like, cut off this conversation and just told Lars, hey.
I'm like, excuse me, sorry, Lars.
Step aside.
Yeah, I want them to know that this is my big dog. Like, you know, they can play all the shows they want, but I don't care. You know, like, I like the other bands that, you know, like Duff McKagan, on the other hand, when I saw him, oh my God, did I nerd out. Because that to me is like someone who's played in all these punk bands that I love, and Guns N' Roses was a band that I definitely loved as a kid. So, you know, when I got to meet Duff McKagan, like, it was a big deal. But anyway, so they play the sideshow, and Danko from Danko Jones and I and interview Jericho for his podcast, and it's just like, it was super fun because he's like, really down to earth and really chill. And then later on, we were kind of hanging out with him. And, you know, the last day of tour, he's telling us this crazy story about how he worked the Rumble for 40 minutes, completely hungover from the night before because he was partying at an award show.
That was crazy when you told me that. You know, he's telling this story, yeah, that he was hungover for the Rumble, if you remember. Yeah, did like 40 minutes in the Rumble the next day.
He said he flew, I think, from Europe to L.A., went out to party at some award show with like Avenged Sevenfold, got up and flew the next morning, maybe even didn't even sleep, to Vegas to work the pay-per-view and, like, you know, work the pay-per-view completely hungover. But you know what? I know another crazy thing is I knew, you know how everyone said, like, there's no way anyone knows that Jericho's going to come out and do this. I knew.
Oh, man.
I knew. Because my friend was doing this thing with them in Toronto that I don't think I'm supposed to mention what it is yet. We'll talk about it off air, John, you know.
Is it I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like maybe you can talk about it. Some sort of web series.
Yeah.
Maybe you're allowed to talk about it.
I think that news got out.
A while ago, okay, yeah. So it's like a web series,
or we're breaking it. One or the other.
Okay, whatever we're doing. Anyway, so he saw the jacket. He saw Jericho had the jacket on set. And he's like, oh, and like just like looks at it, and Jericho puts it away and just like continues talking. And then he's like, yeah, he had the jacket, and I'm like, I bet you he's working the Rumble. I bet you he's gonna fly. And he's like, no, he's flying to L.A. And I'm like, L.A. is close to Vegas, right? Like, you can just drive, like, to Vegas from L.A. And, well, you know, of course, he flew. But, yeah, so I knew. So, yeah, there you go, wrestling world. Some people did know.
Damien Abraham there. You should have tweeted that.
I should have tweeted that and got my friend fired. No, I shouldn't. But, yeah, no, he was just super nice, really down to earth. And I also hung out with this band, the Wonder Years. And they were telling me stories about what's his name from The Shield?
Ben Savage?
No, from The Shield. What's his name? Fred Savage.
Fred Savage.
No.
Ben Savage is Boy Meets World.
Boy Meets World, that's his brother. That's the thing that separates us, you know? I know Fred Savage, and you're more of a Ben Savage guy.
How has Wonder Years never come out on DVD?
I think it's probably music clearance.
It has to be.
You know?
Were they heavy on music on that show?
There is some.
I never got into that show.
There is some. Like, I know that's what took years for Freaks and Geeks to come out. Yeah. Is, like, the music clearance stuff for that. And, you know, in WKRP in Cincinnati. Like
WKRP, they just butcher. It's just all production music that they've thrown over top of it. I bought that series.
It kills it. It's almost like you want to see someone do a fan sub on the internet where they sub in all the original music over top of stuff. But, like, this band, they were telling me, what's his name? Seth Rollins.
Seth Rollins.
Yeah, man. Seth Rollins is like it goes to their shows and like will bust like bust moves off the amps and stuff. And like, I'm like, oh, that's so amazing. So there are tons of work. And then I learned apparently I was hanging out with my friend the other day, and he was telling me that Davey Richards has a Youth of Today tattoo. So there's another hardcore connection.
You ever met Davey Richards?
Never crossed paths with him. Never, not yet, at least. I'm hoping to.
Interesting guy.
Yeah, that's what you say. You know, everyone says, like, oh, he's weird. He's weird. And even my friend, even some friends of mine who know him from, like, I guess punk and hardcore shows are like, yeah, he's pretty quiet. Like, pretty just keeps to himself and stuff. And, like,
does jiu-jitsu and wrestling. That sounds like, and then he's got his,
And supports the youth crew, apparently, too.
Apparently so.
You know? Apparently he's also, like, you know, shouting out...
not big on live interviews, either.
Not big on live, no.
Catch him in person. That's the best time. And just stick a microphone in his face. That's how you get an interview.
I've heard him no-show a couple.
Quite a few.
In my fandom of wrestling podcasts. I've heard him, not show up a little bit. But, you know, like, that being said, like, there's some people that just aren't good at press stuff. You know, like, you know, certain people in my band that I would not want to.
Do you still enjoy doing press stuff?
I love it. I still love it. It's like the only time I really get to, you get to interact with, you know, people, and they're forced to listen to you. You know, they have to hear what you say because they're being paid to be there, hopefully.
Because I imagine it would drive me. I totally understand when it. I think, like, the worst that I have to deal with are main event fighters
on a
big UFC show,
yeah,
where it's like they've done 10,000 interviews, and it's like, man, it's like the bucket of questions is extremely shallow for some of these guys. So it's like that
it's
puts a lot
find.
Of pressure on me that it's like, okay, I don't want to ask these guys just the same old questions that everyone asks. But then there's the other part of me that's like, okay, well, there's people that might be listening to my show that don't listen to other shows and want to hear these things.
Yeah, like I think that's the thing is, like, you know, for. And that's what you got to remember when you're doing the interview is that, you know, you might be saying this story for the 100th time, but you know, it can sound different to you, yeah. You know, and also it's the first time the person's hearing it, you know. And
I was scarred after it was like 2005 or something like that, and I asked Mick Foley about the Hell in a Cell, and he just like sarcastically tore me down, and I was just like, man, it was like the night of a WWE pay-per-view too, and it was like the headliner was a Hell in a Cell match, and I just asked him about, I think I asked a pretty like not just like, hey, tell us about Hell in the Cell with Undertaker. Yeah. It's like I think I had question. A thought-provoking question, yeah. And he was just like, God, what an unoriginal question, or something like that. And it was like, man, like
I
get it too.
Yeah, I don't, because it's like, you know what's way worse? Making a fillet of fish for the millionth time in one day.
Ooh.
You know, like, you know what's worse?
Some truth.
Like,
there are dropped like, down there, by
like,
Damian
yeah,
Abraham.
Like, I don't know, you hear about people that have these jobs, and it's like, yeah, like, I mean, everyone who has a job is entitled to not like it at some point, you know? But that's when it becomes a job, you know? And if you have a job which allows you to kind of, like, do whatever the hell you want for most of the time, and then there's that little bit of time that they force you to do something, it's like, well, that's the job, unfortunately,
yeah.
You know? And it's like, and that's what you got to think about, you know? It's like, and fortunately, like, for me, maybe it's because I enjoy that aspect of it, but, like, that to me never seems like the work. The work seems like the travel in between shows to me is like the driving in a van sitting there endlessly, which just, you know, hence I guess my extreme passion for this podcast, because I spend so many hours listening to it, because you're just driving for forever, you know, and you get to a show and it's largely unchanged. The back of the show is largely unchanged. The venue is largely unchanged. Venues are the same. You know, most of the time these venues are outside of downtowns, like, because that's what cheaper rent is, you know, and so you don't really get to see downtown. Most of the downtown's shut by the time you get there. So, you know, that's where it does grind you down. And so, you know, that to me is the work. And I can see why wrestlers, you know, when they talk about that aspect of the job, I can say like, yeah, that's it. But I don't know. I think interacting with different people every day, I think that's not a challenging part of my job, at least.
Yeah. Well, wait, just give it a few years.
Yeah, that's true. He's been at it a little longer than I have.
Fuck you and your podcast, Pollock. I'm sick of this.
Yeah, we'll do it next time you have me on. It'll be the bitter hour.
I'm gonna leave that England story hanging for the end of the.
Oh yeah, we'll talk about it. Come back to it,
because
maybe it'll come up organically too.
It might set up a future review with Damian later this summer.
Absolutely, perfect, good idea.
It's a long term booking.
That's
here.
Why you're a producer and I'm just the talent, my friend. In our respective lines of work, you're the talent here.
Are you floating around a podcast
a
podcast idea that is that public knowledge?
Yeah.
That's still being worked on.
No, it's still being worked on. I'm talking away about doing a potential music based podcast with them. You know, like both of our schedules being a little busy right now, we haven't had a chance to touch base 100%. So here I am now putting the onus on us to do it in front of everyone.
That's the best thing is talk about it publicly.
But
me and Way's elusive Nunavut documentary.
Yeah.
I feel if I talk about it, that puts more pressure on me to finally.
To make it. Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. We have an episode of The Wedge that's like the Foo Fighters tour that we shot. Like Sandy, our bass player, shot it. She shot it all on camera, and we had like pro microphones. It's got like a 40-minute Dave Grohl interview.
Oh, wow.
It's got me getting my cool germs burn on camera.
Holy
that's
shit.
Like a germs burn is like a cigarette burn that the germs Pat Smear gave the first one to Darby Crash, the singer of the Germs, and it's been passed down, you know, and there's like, it's funny who you see that has them, right? Like all the first wave kind of big punk people have them, and of course being a nerd about them, I wanted to get one.
So I get burnt by a cigarette.
Yeah, so I asked Pat Smear for it on the Foo Fighters tour, and he's like, I only gave one to anyone ever, that's Darby Crash, and then Chris Shiflett, the guitar player of the Foo Fighters, was like, well, I've got one, and I'm like, give me one. And so I get that live on camera and stuff.
That's cool.
And like, yeah, it's got like a yo-yo battle between me and Jack Black. Anyway, it's like so much amazing stuff. Like you're like the Nunavut thing with like Colt Cabana and all these, you know, like stuff that people want to see, you know, and there are people, I would just want to see it. You know, still it's like, just sometimes those are the hardest things to get
it's
to.
It's like our own personal Legends
House. It's our albatross. Yeah, it's our Legends House. It's our Legends House. It's our network.
Exactly.
It's a lot of different things that never came to fruition.
I will have you know that I got my own germs burned when I was 16 at Canada's Wonderland, and a guy was trying to grab his ticket and burnt me with a fucking cigarette by mistake, and it hurt like a bitch.
That's called... The Carney's germs burn.
The Carney's germs burn.
Yeah. Doesn't sound
not as legendary.
Romanticized.
Not as legendary in the annals of rock and roll, but definitely legendary in the circuit.
Oh, Canada's Wonderland. Boy, was that a fun job.
That is, yeah. Like, my friend told me he had sex there one time, and it made every fun experience I have there seem so
Where did
so
he have
mildly.
It? On, like, a roller coaster? Or
everywhere.
Just everywhere.
It was like the dude that, like, in junior high, you're like, you had intercourse? What?
Had to have been on the Wild
Yeah,
beast.
You know, and then I waited. You know, and then it took me 10 years to catch up. But still, anyway. No. Anyway, so he apparently had it all over the place there. It sullied everything I'd done there. Like, everything I felt was, like, so cool. He's like, yeah, I got a hand job on that ride. And I'm like, oh, I went on that with my mom.
Oh, God. The one where you stand up the whole time.
Yeah, oh, probably.
What was that?
What is that one? Yeah, where you're on a bicycle seat.
The Jet Rider, I don't know.
Jet Screamer? No.
Jet Scream is the big ship that goes up. Sky Rider?
It is the Sky Rider. Last time I went there, I was like, you know, probably bigger than I am now. So probably around 300, 290. And none of the four shoulder harnesses fit me properly. It was like someone putting me in some sort of vice death grip.
Oh, wow.
Around my shoulders every time I went on a ride. But I was there with my now wife, but at the time, you know, very recent girlfriend. I didn't want her to know that I was too fat to ride the ride. So I'm just suffering
playing
in silence.
Cool, yeah.
Like, you know, probably could have died.
I once saved a kid from drowning in the lazy river at no
Whoa.
Or whatever that big
yeah,
pool
that,
is.
Is it the lazy river? I think it is.
There's the lazy river, but then there's the actual like
just, the wave pool type thing.
Yeah, okay. That deal. And I was there with my buddy, and he had brought his like younger cousin from like England over, who thought he could swim, couldn't swim, and I see him over in my periphery just like fucking flailing away, and I friggin' just went like David Hasselhoff and like ran in, grabbed him, and picked him up.
Holy jeez.
My only moment of
some people stand in
heroic
the darkness.
Act.
Afraid to step into the light, not John Pollock. He stepped in. That's awesome.
There you go.
Did you have life-saving or anything like that?
Nothing. I was like 12.
Wow, look at you.
There you go. So that's my Canada's Wonderland
story. I always
story.
Wanted to be a lifeguard, but I had man boobs, so I was afraid of taking my shirt off in public back then.
You know what Canada's Wonderland has now? They have this buffet there. It's $20.
A buffet?
Dude, it's like the only reason I want to go to Wonderland
Do they
anymore.
Have the foot-long, the foot-long hot dogs from Top Gun are my favorite thing
Dude,
to
they
eat.
Have like all the food that's out in the park.
Oh my God.
But it's
God.
Like in this, it's like they have, there's like alcohol served there. There's like fucking the ice cream machine. There's like Italian food. Burgers, like, dude, it's the best $20 you'll spend.
I'm going to leave my kids at home that day.
I went there with my buddies the first time we found this, and we sat there for 3.5 hours, man. It was just incredible.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know what, actually, have you ever been to Korean barbecue? Not to give up.
Yes, I have.
I love that place for a long sitting.
Korean barbecue is the best, especially when you walk out onto, like, Queen Street after, and then it all just... You realize what you've put in.
Well, there's one across the street from Vapor Central, the weed bar. So it's like,
oh, well, there you go.
Perfectly positioned.
What a segue.
Yeah, so I just go, you know, I go over and go over. And then, but yeah, it's amazing. It is a incredible. And when I found out they had free refills, this is before I smoked marijuana, I found out they had free refills back when I was straight edge and a little chubbier than I am now, considerably.
Marijuana really, has got you in shape.
It got me in shape. I've lost 100 pounds.
Really? 100 pounds?
100 pounds.
In how much time did that take you?
2 years?
Holy shit,
it's like 50
man.
Pounds.
That's really impressive.
Yeah, like it's been, you know what? I'm really not tried. I really like it. I've modified what I eat insofar as I just eat less of the same crap I always ate, like drink a little less soda. But it's not like I don't yearn for it in the same way. I think for me, because of anxiety and stuff, when I was on tour, I just was like supplementing food for, you know, these anxious feelings that I had, even on the anxious anti-anxiety medication that I was on. So I'd be eating like, I'd go into a restaurant and be like, I'll get the double that and another one of those and a supersize that too. And then we'd stop again. I'd be like, oh, we might as well get some giant Slurpee here and some bag of chips, you know, and it would just be like constantly. And now I don't really feel the need to do that. So I think that's kind of contributed to the weight loss, but so anyway, I still do enjoy Korean barbecue.
Korean barbecue is great for
Toronto.
You.
I gotta say though, is amazing food city, an unbelievable food city.
I think underrated. If you live here, you really don't appreciate it until
you really
go to other places.
There's some cities like people be like, oh, it's no New York and it's no LA, and there's some like there's like Copenhagen in Denmark has like the best restaurant in the world, right? But like just consistent. Any type of food from anywhere in the world within a similar radius or proximity at least, Toronto is untouchable. Untouchable. And late night, too. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've been in a city somewhere and they've been like, I'm like, oh, can I get something to eat? Because I can't eat before we play because I get violently ill on stage, as I did in Taiwan, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was crazy. They also gave me this thing called a beetle bug, which is a they told me it was like gum. So I chewed it, but apparently it's more like chewing tobacco. It's like some sort of stimulant.
Oh, God.
And I threw a ball over the stage. But anyway, I can't tell you how many times I've been somewhere and they've been like, no, there's nowhere to eat after the show. I'm afraid everything's closed. And I'm like, it's 10 o'clock. It's not that late. I'm really, you know, I'm not asking for much. Like, I'm not saying like I want, you know, Ethiopian food at, you know.
When you went out with Anthony Bourdain, you guys, was he impressed with the sea?
Yeah, he was. He was like, I don't know, like the whole way it was kind of framed to us by him is that everyone in Montreal says Toronto's terrible for food, you know. And I think he kind of looked at Toronto as being, you know, like a
second place.
Like a junior New York, yeah. Right? Which, you know, I can see the argument in a lot of ways. Toronto might be a junior New York in a lot of ways, but that's kind of awesome, you know, because it means like everything's that much closer together. Everything's like, you know, it's like maybe there's not quite as much in like the extremes.
Yeah.
But, you know, the middle's awesome, you know, like in Toronto for food, like, and talking as a culinary city, and I think he like, you know, the food he got to eat here was diverse enough and kind of like of a quality that he wasn't expecting, you know. And I can say like Toronto, you know, Montreal is an amazing city. Like it's ridiculous food. Food in Montreal is absolutely.
Schwartz
is like Moishe's Steakhouse, and we're just talking about the most meaty restaurants in the world that are Joe Beef. Like all these places that are just ridiculous, you know. We talked about two restaurants right beside each other there, but Joe Beef and like all these places are just ridiculous there, and it is like an incredible food city. But that being said, like maybe because I don't live there, I don't know about the range of different cultural food that you get in Toronto. Toronto's a very diverse city. You can get like.
You can go Ethiopian. You can go anywhere.
All types of Filipino food. You know, Tibetan food. You can get mainland Chinese food. Like mainland Chinese, all different types of mainland Chinese food. Food, Cantonese food. Man, like you know, all types of Asian cuisine. You can get all types of South American cuisine and stuff like that. So Toronto's very underrated food.
My new thing is dumplings, man. I found this place that's. I think it's like Spadina. Yeah, Dumpling House.
It's crazy. You know,
it's like $15 and you can get like just this insane amount of dumplings.
The most culinary band I've ever met is that band Yola Tango.
The most culinary
band. They are
unofficial.
Well, Action Bronson is like a chef and stuff, but like the Yola Tango people, they booked a tour. There's a restaurant in the Basque region of Spain, like the Basque country in Spain. That's like one of the best restaurants in the world. It takes a year to get reservations. It's a lottery and it's like crazy. It's hard. And the promoter there was like, I got us reservations. They booked a European tour around going to that restaurant.
Wow.
You know, and they when they came to Toronto, they were like, yeah, we're going to Dumpling House. We're going to this place. They had all these like different, they're like, Toronto's a very good city for dumplings we found. So we're going to only dumpling restaurants today and stuff like that. And like, they are talking to those people like they book their tours around food.
I couldn't blame them. If I was in your position, I would just make sure I could get to Ribera Steakhouse.
Oh my God.
That is on my bucket list.
I know. Maybe next time because Chris from Jaw is going to become a dad.
I saw that.
So maybe next time I go there, we're going to have to go to Ribera Steakhouse to celebrate.
Yeah. Wade Barrett just got a jacket there.
Really?
Tweeted out. He's like, now I can officially call myself a pro wrestler.
Man.
See, I feel like you and I, like it's like – we could get jackets, but it's like we would be shunned by pro wrestlers.
Apparently they don't
like,
even now.
They don't even sell them?
No, do not even. I'm sure they get enough
They probably give
getting,
them if there's a worker of
note. But they also probably even get enough indie workers going there buying them.
Yeah,
you know, like
I would
apparently
say so.
You need to be a worker to get one.
Yeah,
and like you know, there's now it's like so how probably you know anyone that does a month tries to go to Japan to work in a dojo is like, I might as well pick the jacket up while I'm here. Or something like that, I can imagine. I don't know, but like, apparently you can't get one. And like, and my insistence on Twitter jokingly that I could was met with like indignation that I would suggest that I could get one.
Oh my goodness.
But apparently there's also like, on Colt Cabana's podcast, I heard there's like, Zubaz.
It's still around, yeah.
But like, no, but like Ribera Steakhouse Zubazes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like there was, I forget who was on it, but he's talking about how he has Ribera Steakhouse Zubaz. And I'm like, That is my new dream apparel.
So it's a piece. Jacket that's Zubaz inspired.
No, no, no. Zubaz pants. That say Ribera Steakhouse on them.
Oh, I see.
Like all over. Oh, you guys made them as like an official merch, you know? They're like, wow, we got enough guys. I'm like, I'm surprised they don't make fanny packs. They probably do make fanny packs, too.
I can't. I'm amazed that Zubaz is still around. I was stunned when I heard
this.
Isn't
it owned by Legion of Doom?
They had a stake in it at one point. I don't think they do anymore. Okay. I think they sold their shares in it. But
got out while the getting was good.
I think they did pretty well.
They looked
at
Sandman. They're like, this is not a franchise player. This is not something we can build this industry on.
The backs of the Sandman.
The backs of the Sandman. That's what this pay-per-view should be called. The backs of ECW.
Well, we did have the Sandman on this show.
I wanted to keep a running tally, but then I forgot because I was in Iran about like all the ECW guys. But like it seemed like most of the dudes had been like, you did a stint, you did a couple shows, you did a show or two.
This was the best I can describe this particular show in this particular time. Is a few weeks ago, I told the story with me and Wei when we were on the QEW and we witnessed this violent car crash. And I would like to say June of 1999 is when you see the SUV swerving. And it's like, it hasn't crashed. No one's hurt. Nothing's damaged. But no good is going to come of this. And you're not going to get control of the wheel again. That's what June of 1999 was to me. And 2000 was like harrowing into a medium.
So who is the creative team at this time? I could have looked back on this, but
this was during the Kevin Nash booking era.
Okay, yeah, that's what I figured.
So you had Nash as kind of like head booker, which pretty much loosely translated to, I'm booking my stuff on top.
Did you hear that Austin podcast he did?
Nash is, yes.
Where he's like, you're a champion. He's like, well, I have the pencil.
Very honest.
Very honest.
I find there's two different Kevin Nashes. There was like, this guy has like become, he's gone from like the scorn of like wrestling fans to like, people love this guy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is like, if you are yourself for long enough, it goes to any aspect of culture now, you will find an audience. You know, I was watching the Pentagram documentary on Netflix. If you ever get a chance.
I haven't seen it.
I can't remember what it's actually called, but it's about the singer of this band Pentagram that were like kind of like, you know, contemporaries of Black Sabbath, but in North America, like early 70s, never went anywhere. But everyone's like, this band should have been huge. And it's like the singer became like the worst kind of like drug, addicted kind of state. Type living situation.
Didn't get a chat from Johnny Ramone.
Oh my gosh, never got a Johnny Ramone chat. And but it's like all about him kind of like coming back. And it's an amazing documentary, but like, anyway, goes to show that it at this time period that like, if you wait long enough, you can find an audience for anything, you know? And here's this guy finding his audience. And I think Kevin Nash is now finding his audience.
And an incredibly personable guy. Like, anytime I've chatted with him, extremely nice guy. Will joke about his failings in the past. If you even want to call that, he's very blunt about the fact, listen, I made a lot of money in wrestling.
But I screwed up.
And it's, I think that there's a certain endearing quality to this guy. But this time period, I think, is what is most brought up with Kevin Nash was the period where he was, the head booker and he had like kind of Dusty Rhodes kind of working on like the undercard and stuff like that. But that's kind of what this was. It was like Eric Bischoff was kind of, he was still involved. He was still like the executive vice president of the company. He would last on that role for a couple more months at this point. But Nash, this was at his most influence.
Was
it
Bob Mould there yet?
Bob Mould started a few months after this show. Yeah, he started like September.
Okay, because he was he's always said that Kevin Nash is still his best friend in the business.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Yeah, for sure. Also. That's a future show. We got to get Bob Mould on with you.
I would love that. That would be amazing. He and I hung out like a couple months ago in Spain on the way back on the way to an airport, and it's just like you know, him and his band and me and my band, and he and I are just talking about wrestling, like just like. A New Japan, like Kevin Steen. We haven't seen each other in a long time, so we're just like unloading over the last kind of couple years of wrestling. And everyone in both bands is just like, oh my God, like dead silent, just like staring at the floor, so bored. But we're just like, I'm just like nerding.
It's like each
out.
Of your respective bands. Just oh, yeah. Like, oh,
well, because like, you know, like he's a guy who still watches, you know?
And oh,
like,
he still does watch.
Oh, still watches. Wow. Still is a big fan. Wow. Still like keeps up and like as much, I guess, as he can on the road and stuff. But
like Bob Mould to me is like someone that. Everything on the surface, you would think, like, what a horrible idea. Like, here's a guy in a band, clearly was a fan. Let's put him on the creative team. Sounds like a horrible idea on paper. And this guy, I don't think you didn't have any idea just the insight this guy had. And this guy was, like, scouring the indies in 2000, recommending, like, CM Punk in 2001. Yeah. Think about that. A year before ROH even started.
He also, you know, at the time, like, he went to AWA and was, like, kind of like, you know, selling programs, he told me, and was like just trying to get in there. And it's like, man, you were kind of in like a pretty popular band, you know, to be doing that. Like, it makes me kind of like, part of me was like, oh man, I kind of want to go and just like kind of get more into wrestling. And I'm like, nah, I can't. I'm like, I can't do that. I'm too busy. And I'm like looking at Bob Mould. I'm like, well, he did it. Like, he wound up writing for WCW in the worst possible circumstance, I imagine, to work there. But
He was like WCW's Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yeah, I know exactly. That's the other thing that I heard.
High profile hire.
Did you hear that on tour? They talked to Krista Joseph about Freddie Prinze Jr. this week on the Torch Talk.
No, I didn't hear that.
It was pretty funny too. Like, talking about Freddie Prinze Jr. is the only guy in creative that could walk in and out of Vince's office, like, just whenever he wanted. Like,
oh yeah,
just like waltz in and be like, hey, here's my idea. Here's what I don't like. Here's what's going on. Blah, blah. And Stephanie, and apparently they were both like just like enamored with celebrity.
Wow.
Beyond belief. So that's it. I'm just got to wait till like Fucked Up becomes a little more mainstream, which will never happen. And I'll be set for writing a WWE.
Damien Abraham, creative team member.
Oh, man. And then I will quit within the first day. I'll be like, fuck this. I'm not going to get into a fist fight with the Freebird, you know, and I'll quit.
Were you watching WCW at this time?
I kind of was. I was kind of coming home and watching it. It was also like,
it was always a lot tougher, I think, for Canadians to follow WCW.
It was harder. It was on Tuesdays or Wednesdays.
Wednesdays it was on in the 3-hour formation.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, at this point in time, at least the shows were airing. But it's like kind of crazy to imagine that, like, I remember Mondays, like, I'd try to avoid spoilers all the way until Wednesday. You know what I mean? And then you would get to see the show. It was on like 3 to 6 on TSN.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of like, I did follow WCW at this point, kind of closeted secretly. I was like a wrestling fan. I just didn't like the kids at my school that liked wrestling, but it was so,
I was completely on my own at school.
Yeah.
At this point in time, even at the hot period in 99, it was like,
oh, there was a lot. It was so like, there was like, you know, tons of kids at my school that were like Austin fans, and like,
I guess during this time, you're right. Like, there were definitely like WWF fans.
Yeah,
like,
WWF,
sense.
and even WCW, because there was the game. You know, like, there was the N64 game where everyone knew all the characters and knew the roster. So when it did air, you knew all these people. I think my first interaction with WCW was an ad in a comic book for the Nintendo game, or maybe it was the first WCW action figures that they did in the mid 80s.
Oh wow!
And I remember seeing, I can't remember who it was, but I'm just like, that's them, but they're wearing different colors. Like, what's going on here? And that was like my first, there's like other wrestling federations.
Like, I literally, like, my limited viewing of WCW in like the mid 90s, it was like the pay-per-view Barker channels would have like the countdowns. And I was always like, here is like wrestling that is not WWF.
Yeah.
And, you know, the British Bulldog is now over here. That explains why he's not in WWF anymore. And then it was just, I never had TBS when I was a kid, so I couldn't watch Saturday night. And then it was, I guess, like 96 when Hogan turned heel, and I heard about this and was like, wow, I really want to try and find this. And it was like Nitro in like 1-hour highlight form 6 days after it aired. That's like, that was what we were limited to.
And I think that's the other thing is, like, NWO, I think, hit so much bigger in America than it did in Canada. Like, I think the Austin thing and then the D-Generation.
Well, they never toured up here, really.
Yeah, they never toured here.
Like, until that Nitro in like 99.
Didn't have TV for it, really.
Yeah, it was really hard. Like, at least WWF, even in their lowest points in the mid 90s, they did very well up here because they had TV up here.
I guess we were the territory for them, too.
Yeah, so it was always kind of, it was much easier to follow WWF up here. But at this point, I mean, they had their television up here. I mean, you had Nitro and Thunder at this time.
Yeah, and I think TBS became something you didn't have to pay for, or maybe I had better cable. Because I stayed at my dad's. My parents got divorced, and I was staying at my dad's, and I think he had better cable or something. Because I do remember being able to watch it quite a bit. And, like, when I was watching this, I'm like, well, I knew every single character. And, like, I might not have been watching at this exact time, because I think this was during the first tour I ever did when I roadied for my friend's band in the U.S. But I do remember, like, all this kind of, like, era. And all these kind of characters.
I remember that was my first anger at the CRTC, where I couldn't understand. They would plug Nitro, and it was like, okay, everyone that I know gets to watch this in the U.S. Why the fuck does TNT not air in Canada?
Yeah.
And I would, like, scour my TV guide. I'm like, it's got to be somewhere. Like, why is it not on TV here in this country?
Couldn't you get TNT if you paid for a satellite? Maybe?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I thought I had a friend that had, like, a crazy satellite dish that was just in a wrap. And we watched this.
I'm sure if you had some illegal dish, you could
Master
get it.
Maybe Master P was on it or something. We were watching some of the stuff on paper. Maybe we were just watching pay-per-views. But yeah, no, it was. It's really frustrating. And that still frustrates me. Like, there'll be, like, some show. I remember when Sopranos, you know, like, because in the news, when Sopranos was first airing, and we couldn't watch it in Canada, and you'd have to rent it.
Yeah.
From a video store that would illegally transfer the English DVDs over.
Ask for the Sopranos, and the guy, like, walks to the back.
He's back. It's
quietly
yeah.
brings it back.
You kids with your internet will never have to deal with this.
So this particular pay-per-view going into it, they had this kick on to try and get some new talent over, and Buff Bagwell was at the top of their list.
He's my most hated wrestler. Like, I still, like, when my wife and I got married, before we got married, when we first lived together, I went through her stuff, and she used to, this is her dirty secret, but she used to like wrestling.
Whoa.
And I found an NWO.
It's like being in a ska band.
Yeah, exactly. And I found an NWO tape, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to watch this NWO video. This should be awesome. Right? You know, because I know it sucks, but I kind of like when the NWO starts. It's hosted by Buff Bagwell. Oh, I hate wow. him so much. Like, how is this guy a face? Like, you just want to hate him so, so much.
Well, he was their chosen young talent at this point in time. So he was one of the keys. And they had just signed a deal with Tommy Boy Records, to have a relationship where, their music would be on Nitro and such. And included in this deal, they made, an offer for Master P, as I mentioned, $200,000 per appearance, along with his No Limit Soldiers, which also consisted of his cousin Swole.
Yeah.
Who had started training 8 years ago and wanted to become a wrestler. So WCW, seeing the potential of this guy, inked him to a deal for 400.
8 years earlier he started training?
He started training 91.
And that's where he's at? He does a shoulder block?
He did a shoulder block. At $400,000 a year,
oh,
they signed
my
him to.
Gosh, that's
Think
crazy.
Of that.
I'm like, I always thought the thing was that he brought this guy in with no training.
Like, this guy was, I believe, this was also the summer where Chris Jericho was leaving.
Yeah, Chris Jericho's in this pay-per-view in the background.
And I'm fairly certain that Jericho signed with WWF for less than what Swole signed with WCW for.
Well, also, it's with Master T.
Master P.
Sorry.
As someone that works at Much
Music.
I wonder
if Much Music. I have Much Music on the brain 24/7. Master P, with Master P, like, this is after they were talking about how he played for the Charlotte Hornets, but actually, he also played for the Raptors.
That is true.
You know, he didn't actually, I don't think, ever play a game.
It was like a year after this, and it was like...
No, I think it was before this, wasn't it?
Was it before?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was still in high school, because my friend's little brother got one of Master P's shoes.
Oh, my God.
They went to the locker room, and he started talking to Master P, and Master P gave him a shoe.
What are your non-wrestling impressions of Master P? Because he, to me, was never someone that, like... They're listing off, like, how much money this guy made a year, and it was like... Sounds like he was in tune with, like, branding himself and shit.
Oh,
but it was like, I don't know, was this guy really a force in the music world?
Oh, absolutely. For like a time period. But the thing is, like, hip hop's like a weird thing where it's not like rock and roll where you get an ascension, you know, where you kind of like after you're really popular, kind of graduate to like a legendary status. It's with hip hop, it just moves, you know, unless you're like Jay-Z or Snoop Dogg or like a perennial kind of like, you know, like chart. Stadium filler. Just Drake is probably in there now. Lil Wayne might be in there now. Eminem's in there. You know,
Drake still can't get into the Miami Heat.
That's
locker
true.
Room
apparently,
game
like
seven. So
started from the bottom. Still here. You know, outside the locker room waiting to get in. Don't worry, I'm still be there too, Drake. But like, you know, like you get all these. But like that being said, you also have all these people like that were there, and now you don't really hear about them anymore. You know, and it's weird because you don't
unforgiving industry.
It's an unforgiving industry, and I think, but Master P at the time, he was huge. He had that song Bout It, and I remember like loving that song, and that was before Make Him Say kind of came out. But that song was amazing too. I think in retrospect, like what they did and Juvenile was kind of like. Give Southern hip hop, like there was obviously UGK and other people before that from the South that were huge, Scarface and stuff. But what they did was like cast sort of like the mainstream media, like to the point where wrestling channels or wrestling shows, sorry, on mainstream cable channels are hiring them to come in for exorbitant amounts of money.
This would be the same company that sought out Master P, and then 2 months later they would hire Kiss to do a live concert on Nitro.
They had some amazing music stuff, like the and actually there's all Jimmy Hart's wearing a blazer with the Misfits skull on the the back at one point. But the fact that they brought in the Misfits, Insane Clown Posse, Kiss,
Chad Brock,
like they really, really like
they covered the gamut.
They covered the gamut. They were like anything, like okay. And I kind of always wonder why TNA doesn't do that. You know, like if I were like TNA, and like TNA used to kind of make these kind of forays, like random forays into things a little bit more. But if I was TNA, like, yeah, like maybe have on like, you know, like Lars from Rancid, like be like, hey, do you want to come on and do something? Like, are you like
how excited them? Did you get that? Lars?
I met Lars the other day too.
Really?
Talked wrestling with him for like 2 minutes, but he's my friend's in a band with him, so that was my entrance point, and then I just immediately steered the conversation to wrestling.
Well, there was that Rancid show like a month ago where he said he's just written new music for CM Punk, and
yeah,
apparently a total swerve, I guess.
I heard though that he could, maybe they just wouldn't let them use it, because I think Rancid, from what I understand, is they're very smart with their business and like keep it very tight, and I can't imagine WWE in a licensing deal for a song.
Well, they just spent like all this money on Cult of Personality. It's like, this is your song from now on.
That's true. Which is cool, but it's like, you know, Living Color is not very reflective of CM Punk. You know, I love Living Color too, but it's reflective of CM Punk as the cult leader character that he was doing now. But CM Punk in 2013 is a public character where we all know what he actually listens to because he made a whole movie about it, which is... That CM Punk documentary is something else. There are some amazing name drops in that documentary.
What did you think of Living Color at WrestleMania?
I thought it was awesome. I love Living Color, but they're not a punk band. But that being said, like, I love Living Color. And you know, it was kind of cool to see, you know, here's this band that had this, like, one, you know, anomaly kind of hit. But, like, you know, we're like, a legitimate band outside of that, but had, like, one anomaly kind of hit. And here they are, you know... 20 some odd years later with the same anomaly hit.
And now, like, their hardcore fans are going to be like, man.
I don't know how many.
They played a show with Diddy.
I don't know how many hardcore fans. I think they're grateful for any fan in 2013. You know, it's not like. They're not like, you know, Cro-Mag's doing that for CM Punk. Now, that would be something I'd love because, you know, CM Punk, when he comes out, he goes, it's clobbering time, right? Like, that's his big thing. That's a song, right? Well, it's obviously what, you know, he's like, oh, it's what the thing.
Yeah,
shouts out. But like, you know, CM Punk, Truth Zone, I know you like comics. I like comics too, but I'm a hardcore kid. And I know in Sick of It All, like they have this song, dun, 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 it's clobbering time. It goes in this huge breakdown. And I just think CM Punk, if
you
use that.
You sync it up for when he yells
it. Oh, it'd be incredible. It would be incredible because it's got like the buildup. And I'm sure he must have used it because it's almost like his walk before he gets down on one knee is almost perfectly in time.
Slow zoom up the aisle into his mouth.
Why aren't you and me, Kevin Dunn, get out of there. Let John and Damian take over.
Hey,
And Way, too, obviously. I'm not taking Way.
Yeah, we'll put Way in the production truck.
Way, it's in the truck. I'm going to work my way on the camera, Vince Russo style.
All right. We're at an hour, and I've gone through my first point of my 5 pages.
I know it sucks. I'm going to New York Wednesdays. So this would be Review Away is my Wednesday listen while I'm, you know, going to work. But I'm going on tour. on Wednesday, and now here it is with a super long Review Away that I can't listen to.
It's still the greatest compliment I've ever got is where Damien's like, oh, I'd love to do the show, but man, it cuts out me listening.
It does. It really screws up my perfectly budgeted times for podcast.
Well, there's about 8,000 other shows I do every week. So
I'm gonna I'm gonna have to settle for Review and Impact. No, I listen to everything. You're already on the schedule every slot, John. You know, you need to make more shows is what you need to do.
Yeah, maybe I'll just do an hourly show every single day and just
what's
keep
up, Damien?
Talking.
What's up, Damien? I just need it for when I'm on tour, really. So you don't have to do it every day. Just like, you know, 2 weeks coming up at the end.
I'll get you to your schedule and we'll work it around.
Okay,
that.
Perfect.
Last Great American Bash question. Are you going to go to the Fozzie show with Saxon in September?
I'm going to try. If we're in town, I'll tell you one thing.
I don't really know Saxon. So
Saxon's unbelievable. Like that Saxon is like new wave of British heavy metal is like right. What we define as heavy metal. That kind of starts with new wave of British heavy metal. That's what Metallica is super.
And they're headlining this show.
Yeah. And Saxon is like, it'd be like Saxon, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Motorhead, you know, I'm like leaving off other bands here, but those were like kind of like the figures. And Saxon's definitely like right up there as one of the originals of that. And like talking to Jericho, he is as nerdy as I am about punk, about metal. So for him, this must be like, you know, like fantasy baseball, getting to hang out with these guys and being on tour with these guys and stuff. It was like funny seeing him and Danko Jones talk. Like they're both nerds about like rock and metal and stuff. And I'm like, okay, let's talk about wrestling.
Okay, back to the Rumble.
Back to the Rumble.
Anyway, show starts off with Master P and the No Limit Soldiers getting out of a limo. As I mentioned, I had really no recollection of this show, but I made the decision to review this show based on this opening scene where I saw Master P and the No Limit Soldiers. I was like, let's do this.
And I think you really get to see in this scene that the No Limit Soldiers had no training. Like, one of them might have had some training, but like their reaction when security comes in is just like, okay, now we're getting crazy. Now we're getting crazy. Now that security's here.
Kurt Hennig comes up with a CD to really date this event from 1999. And
now he asks for an iPhone picture.
Identifies himself as Bowdy Bowdy and says he loves rap music, gets it signed, and then destroys the CD in front of these eight men who their retaliation was not to attack this man, but to yell,
hoo-dee-hoo,
and convey their anger at Kurt Hennig via their words and not fighting.
Yeah.
What an intimidating group.
Oh, not a very intimidating group. Throughout this entire pay-per-view, not
limit soldiers. They know their limits here, and Kurt Hennig was representing that limit.
But like, there are dudes probably in that group that are legitimately terrifying people, but you would not know that from the hootie hoo moment.
Now, we look in hindsight here. It was like the No Limit Soldiers and Master P, they had a really hard time getting across as these, you know, baby faces. Coming in, would you have positioned this group as heels, or do you think they just did it really wrong here?
I think they did it wrong. Like, I was thinking about this, like, you know, it's not like – this is in Baltimore, right? So there's probably going to be more – like, you can't even say there's, like, a natural country music bias.
No.
But like, Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, is the best heel of all time.
This was some of his – this I would say this run was his best crazy. Work in WCW.
Oh, it's crazy, like, how great he is and how good he is at, like, eliciting what he wants in the audience. But he also is, like, kind of a charisma black hole where he sucks everyone. Like, you know, Master P, you see him in his video, he's charismatic. You see him here, he looks tiny. Like, and he also just has, like, no personality because, like, Mr. Perfect's eating up the scenery.
Yeah.
He looks like the way bigger star. Mr. Perfect looked like, you know, and especially because he's, like, they're all dressed the exact same in camouflage. You know, it's not like – it's like if you brought him in, gave him a chance to get over as himself, you know, maybe with just, like, two guys, you know, and then – but instead he comes in a group.
I just don't know what – like, Master P, he didn't want to wrestle. He wasn't going to take bumps. It's like – what are we really getting out of this other than look at this famous guy on our television?
Like, thing. And that's the thing. WWE at least knows to keep those people that don't want to get physical out of the ring and just use them in a shot off to the side. And also they don't pay for them a lot of times. A lot of times they probably just get a free ticket, you know, and a chance to promote their record. And
here's 200 grand.
Yeah, here's 200 grand. Show up.
Per appearance. That's unbelievable. Then we got the opening video. And by the time I watched this opening video.
You want to see this
dude,
show.
Dude, I was stoked. Oh. It was all built around the Nash Savage match that would be our main event tonight. This included Nash attacking Randy Savage with raw sewage, Randy Savage wearing a hideous pink coat, a contortionist that got out of a gym bag to pour raw sewage onto Randy Savage, and then our top babyface Kevin Nash being propositioned for a threesome. As he gets into a limo with these women, they then lock the door. Savage drives the limo, and yes, everyone, the white Hummer drives out of nowhere and smashes into the limo, thereby possibly killing Kevin Nash on the go-home Nitro to lead into this pay-per-view. Take my $30, WCW. I cannot wait for this show.
But it's funny, though. WWE kind of took a lot from this, right? Like, this is the Bret Hart T-boning of the limo a couple years later, the raw sewage being dumped on people's heads. A couple years later in WWE. Like,
oh, this is all wrestling cliches. Here.
Yeah, like, but this is before WWE did the sewage on the head thing, right? The sewage drop. Which
yeah,
really,
probably.
And this is also before the Bret Hart T-boning. But I guess there's other limo. You're a car angle expert. I don't know why I'm.
Oh,
trying
this
to
was car maybe the biggest car angle.
Yeah, exactly.
One. Like the white Hummer driver is like in infamy. Like this cliffhanger that was never resolved in WCW. They never did pin someone as the driver. And all
who
this.
Was driving the car when they hit Bret Hart? A couple years ago.
Oh, right before WrestleMania?
Yeah.
Again, it's an angle I shut out of my mind.
Because I don't know they must have revealed that. No, maybe it's like one of
I think they did reveal it.
Okay.
I cannot remember that angle at all.
Yeah, it was like the same time as the Raw GM, so there's a lot of hanging chads.
This white Hummer at one point was going to be Carmen Electra.
Was driving it?
But that fell through.
Well, Kevin Nash shows later on that he has no problem with violence against women, so I think that could have built to a match.
Well, there's plenty of that on this show.
Oh, my gosh.
Our announcers for the show, Tony Schiavone, who welcomes us to the final summer of the millennium and the best WCW has to offer. That sounded so tongue-in-cheek the way he delivered it.
These guys look so defeated the entire pay-per-view.
This was a job for these three as we go back. Yeah. Bobby Heenan and Mike Tenay joining Tony Schiavone, and of all three, it's just, I found it comical that Mike Tenay was leaned on to put over Master P's talents as the biggest rap star in the world, mentioning Swole, and he's also a sports agent and movie star.
I like the movie star part, because they made movies, but no one saw them. So,
movie star. They gave an update on Kevin Nash, who suffered a rib injury from this Hummer. And wants Savage's top rope elbow drop reinstated for the main event tonight. What a gutsy baby face.
Well, he needs to no-sell it later on, so he had to have it reinstated.
Then they went to a video on Hack versus Brian Knobbs, hardcore Hack being the Sandman.
Because my introduction to him was not through ECW and Sandman. It was through Hack.
Do you remember they brought
him in awesomely.
They brought him in first as like this preppy, like,
oh,
do you remember this vignette they shot where it was like Raven and Canyon at a pool at like Raven's mom's house or something? And then his buddy, I don't even know if they called him Hack. It might have been another name, but he came in wearing like a cardigan, and it was like they were going to position him completely differently than Sandman, and I thought it was a kind of cool way to do it, and they just dropped it, and then he came in a few weeks later as Hardcore Hack.
Because I remember when he came in as Hardcore Hack, and he had a helmet of barbed wire on at one point, and my only knowledge of him was through pictures that I had seen of him, and he was on the cover of the ECW CD, music CD, so I knew him from that, and knew he was going to be awesome, and then just to watch him just like spiral down the card immediately.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh, this guy sucks. But now I love him again.
This video, the voiceover identifies two wacky hardcore guys. That's what we were about to see. And this was a video pretty much teeing up all the matches for tonight, including Buff Bagwell would take on Disco Inferno over who was going to carry the ball that WCW was going to hand them. I mean, how does a viewer that's not like on the internet really understand that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of those throughout the show tonight where they're like using potato, they're using swerve, they're using a lot of things where you're like, you know, now I think you get away with that, you know, a lot more, but people don't do it because it's kind of silly. But then it's like, who? You would have had to really be in the know. You know, you have to be, you know, you have to be Dave Meltzer or like a Dave Meltzer disciple to know what's going on with that stuff.
Gene Okerlund was all decked out in this white suit, made a reference to the Baltimore Ravens, and then plugged Ross Foreman's WCW hotline report later tonight. And then mentions that Nash wants the elbow reinstated, said he wants Savage's elbow reinstated, just the body part, I assume.
Yeah, well,
didn't mention the elbow drop.
No, just like now he can use the bionic elbow. He can use the roaring elbow. He's got his elbow arsenal reinstated.
So opening match was Brian Knobbs accompanied by.
It's pretty full. That was the other thing I noticed about this. The product's still pretty hot at this time, right?
Hey, they were still doing tremendous numbers for Nitro, at this point.
The big crowd, and the crowd seemed – was that piped in, some of that cheering, or was that
– it might have been. I mean, there was some papering on this show, but still like a healthy audience. I mean, the big drop was like – 99, it was like – it was very obvious. Like the creative was really starting to be terrible, but – WCW still had a lot of buzz because it takes a while, I think, for something to come down. It's looking at 1999 to 2000 where it was like there was the crazy drop off, you know, where people weren't buying the product anymore. They weren't buying tickets. They weren't buying pay-per-views. But 99, I mean, it was still a very salvageable product. I think up until the end of 99, you still could have turned things around. Match started off, we had Brian Knobbs accompanied by Jimmy Hart, who is trying to reform the First Family, taking on Hack accompanied by Chastity in a kendo stick match. And Knobbs cuts a promo, "Listen up, you losers," and says that tonight it's Mrs. Nasty's birthday, and he promised her he will destroy Hardcore Hack for her.
I love also that Chastity has a Chelsea cut at that time.
He challenges Hack to get rid of these sissy kendo sticks and toys, and they're going to use their fists. We got to meet Brian Knobs a couple of weeks ago.
I know,
ago.
I heard. I heard he was working the room, trying to get some
He was very much interested in doing an interview.
He's a reality TV star, you know, John. You know, he was on Hogan Knows Best for a season. He was a babysitter.
It's amazing. I completely blank out that Brian Knobs was a part of WCW during this period.
Yeah.
I just kind of think of Knobs and Sags as like mid-90s WCW, and that was kind of the last you heard of them. But Knobs is like, he was there like pretty much until the end in 2001.
And then
like
they came back for TNA.
Yeah.
So they're, you know.
So Knobs here in 1999 taking on Hardcore Hack. So he challenges Hack to have a non-weapons hardcore match. And then Knobs immediately grabs a garbage can and hits him with Schiavone yelling, "It's the first swerve of the night."
Yeah. And then it proceeds to have like four or five more other lines about swerves.
It was great. And believe me, these were a night of swerves.
It's crazy how many swerves they
Schiavone had looked at his format.
They delivered, you know? Like, if he had said that and it had all been straight-up finishes for the rest of the night or with no one turning on anyone, you could have been like, this show did not deliver.
No,
this show
delivers. He's like, these poor fans, they're in for a long one tonight.
Yeah.
Anyway, Knobs attacks him with just lid shots. Hack gets his boot up and then hits a chair to the face of Knobs. I enjoyed because I did post the whole Great American Bash. It's on YouTube, and I clicked on it to watch, and the comments are like, oh, Pollock's really going to enjoy this opening match with all the shots to the head. I mean, that's what this was. These are the hardcore matches I hated, where it was just gratuitous shots with like garbage cans, kendo sticks, just every little spot. Knobs brought a ladder in trying to do the Terry Funk spot, but ended up tripping and falling over.
And that's when he says, I think it's Tanae says, he potatoed him.
He potatoed him. Hack just killed himself in this match.
Yeah.
And it was like, man, I wish someone had just sat down Hack and been like, listen, this company is just throwing money out. Do the least amount of work as much money as you can. Don't kill yourself for these matches that don't mean anything.
It's that top rope onto the ladder.
He took a flip onto the ladder off
that,
the top rope.
That, I was going to say, though, that's like his spot. And he does it like every match that I've ever seen of him with a ladder in it, he will do that spot. He will find a way to like – and it's like there's no way to not take all of that. You know, like even if you're using your elbow to stop your head from hitting it, you're like on your elbow. It's just like, oh.
Jimmy Hart got on the apron, grabbing a chair. Always a fun spot when you know how that's going to end.
Yeah.
But Hack threw Knobs into the chair, and Jimmy Hart took a big bump off the apron here to the floor. And then Hack hit him with a kendo stick and pinned him at 5 minutes and 42 seconds. But then right afterwards, Hugh Morris runs in, and they just beat up on Hack. They hit him with a spike pile driver. Hugh Morris puts a ladder on top of Hack and then delivers a moonsault to the ladder. Yeah, he got the point. Like, who's thinking, I'm going to show him here by breaking my own ribs here on this spot?
I think like, it's just the entire end of this match, you're like, there's a really easy way to do the exact same thing you just did with one of these moves.
I love the idea that when Knobs found out he was losing in this match, he's like, well, I better get my heat back.
Yeah, I'm not.
Because God forbid Brian Knobs falls down the pecking order and puts over Hardcore Hack
clean. I will say that with him, with Jimmy Hart, him, and later with Flair and Arn Anderson, this is like the last period for like sort of the classic TV wrestlers to still be good.
Yeah, it really was, though I will say Ric Flair did not have a classic on this show.
He did not have a classic match, but like I still think him and Piper could do something, you know, approaching entertaining matches, whereas, you know, now it's like they have both aged a lot and are still kind of doing stuff. Not so much now, but a couple years ago.
Speaking of Piper, he was in the back and his young pupil Buff Bagwell comes up as Piper says, "Hey, Stuff."
Yeah.
What's going on, Stuff? And Bagwell thanks him for his match with Disco Inferno and giving him the ball. And Piper calls him a kid after he leaves and says something under his breath. And then Tanae explains that the young talent, they want a shot in WCW. And Piper, who we just watched blow off Buff Bagwell, by him winning tonight, it's going to open the door for young talent to get over. That was the storyline.
Yeah.
Piper winning is going to break the glass ceiling that exists in this environment in WCW.
It's that half pulling the curtain back.
Yeah.
You know?
And putting, we should mention here that at this time, Ric Flair was the on camera WCW president.
Yeah.
And him and Piper were going to have a match tonight for control of the company, fourth match in. The fate of WCW will be decided tonight. In tonight's mid card.
Yeah. I mean, which also, but it just doesn't seem like that affected even the main event storyline at all. Like,
none.
It affects the, I guess, the match just before the main event a little bit, but like, it was like WCW at this time, like, in WWE, I guess the complaint is always that, like, the McMahons will dominate when they're around, and they're always like, you know, it's always like a power struggle storyline when they're around. That you can't say that about WCW. You can have a power struggle going around, and like you can just be like, "Nah, I'm a main eventer. I don't worry about that bullshit."
You can tune that out. Mikey Whipwreck, who I guess would be number two on your count tonight, taking on the latest WCW project and a guy who'd been around forever in this company, Van Hammer,
who did have a Lane Stanley vibe. To bring it back to what I was talking about when he was coming to the ring. Wearing those sunglasses with his hair.
He had a Scott Putski vibe to me.
Definitely, yeah. Well, there's a lot of dudes.
Quite a few. Are we going to keep count on this show? Because there were quite a few bodies.
I was thinking, I don't think we need to keep count yet because I think their main eventers are still to come.
My goodness. Van Hammer had an airbrush singlet that read Hammer on it, along with his shades that he wore inside. Chris Jericho vibe there.
Chris Jericho vibe. No, nothing about this guy. Listen, nothing about this guy should ever be said in the same sentence as Chris Jericho.
It's way more entertaining to watch Tony Schiavone and really listen to what he's saying, where he literally sets this one up by saying, "This could be a very good match, but it's up to Mikey Whipwreck." Like, this is just completely...
And I think this is the only match he worked, right? He works two matches in WCW?
He worked a handful. It was like...
Because he sat at home. He was being...
Oh, he sat home a lot. He did more than two matches, but it was, like, very few and far between. And another guy where I guess this was kind of drilled into, like, you know, Sandman, who, you know, I've gone off my distaste in this guy's abilities in ECW, but nonetheless, came to WCW to work hard. Yeah. And Whipwreck was the same, where it was like... These guys, it's like, these guys easily could have coasted at the money they were making, but it was like, you had really two different styles of talent at this time. The kind that, no matter what they were making, they were going to go out there and work hard, and others who were like, it was a paycheck. And Whipwreck just killed himself here, and I look at, you know, the injuries this guy would incur, and it's like, maybe it would have been fine if he just coasted a little bit more.
When wrestlers talk about great workers, they're like the great workers. When wrestlers are talking about it, they always say, like, it's someone that can get less, that does less but gets more.
Exactly.
Right? And I think that's true, and that's why you never really talk about Mikey Whipwreck and Sammy. Even though I love watching both their matches, they're not really great workers because they had to do a lot. You know, and they got a lot of punishment. Doing a lot.
That's why I always appreciated, you know, when Dusty Rhodes would do the occasional match, like a decade ago with like TNA or something. It's like the crowd just was nuts for this guy. Mm-hmm. Or if you watch, you know, Hogan and Rock, it's like Hogan gets by in that match. It's like it's so little about what he's doing. It's just the reaction he gets and how he does
things. You watch Japanese guys, too. You know, like any of the sort of like legendary Japanese
Kojima
guys are
right
still
now.
Doing it. Yeah.
I mean, he's extremely limited, but he knows what he can do well and what gets reactions. And that to me is what I love about pro wrestling is guys that can get to that stage. Mm-hmm. And it's like they don't need to do every move in the book. They can do a few things really well and the crowd reacts to them 10 times than someone doing a 450 off the
and
top.
Daniel Bryan, too. Daniel Bryan's a guy that he does a lot and gets takes a lot of punishment, as illustrated by last week. But he's another guy that, you know, when he does something, it's like, oh, other guys do that and no one cares. But when he does it, he picks it, does it in the right sequence where it's like, oh, my God, everyone's going nuts.
This is the first time in the history of wrestling podcasts that a Van Hammer match has segued into a brand new Daniel Bryan discussion.
I think that's 2013. It's all on the table now.
Well, Van Hammer comes out and hits him with a backbreaker, and Tanay just starts asking if we know who the white Hummer driver was, and Tanay says that Nash has been on the internet and wrestling hotlines trying to find out who the driver is, which was hilarious because it was literally Nash who it was up to decide who the driver was at this time. Van Hammer hit this Beal off the corner turnbuckle to Whipwreck. Crowd was pretty tired about 3 minutes into this. I don't know why they went as long as they did. There was one good spot here by Van Hammer where he hit this delayed vertical suplex off the second turnbuckle, which, good balance here. You don't see this too often. So there, Van Hammer, I'm giving him some credit here. Then he went into an abdominal stretch, held Whipwreck and climbed the steps on the floor and then just dropped him on the guardrail where it looked like Whipwreck damaged his knee. Whipwreck got a brief comeback, hit a leg drop and a plancha to the floor where Van Hammer was kind of out of position. But then back in the ring, Whipwreck got caught by Hammer off the turnbuckle, hit a spine buster, took down the straps, and hit his Cobra Clutch into a slam for the win at 8 minutes and 35 seconds. And then Van Hammer slowly walks up to the camera and says, I've got nothing to say to you.
Yeah, and it's like, I guess that's post-Stone Cold Steve Austin. If you're a generic guy, you were just a jerk. You know, you just were mean to everyone.
Asshole baby faces. One of the byproducts of the late 90s.
I thought one of the best calls in this match was someone, I forget, I think it's probably Schiavone. Says like, Mikey should use his Ray style offense. It's like, you should use more of a Ray Mysterio style offense.
Ray style. I thought you said race style.
Ray style, yeah. Like, use more of a racialist offense. No, but just Ray Mysterio style offense. Like, I don't think that's really his point.
We saw Michael Sauro in the crowd, the winner of the WCW MasterCard.
He was sitting at the
sweepstakes.
Back.
Yeah, great tickets. Sign me up for that WCW MasterCard now.
And I think like they were trying to make light of that because they come back and they're like, oh, Brain, did you pawn your tickets to the front row or something? Or
something hilarious about a company that would lose $60 million pushing a credit card.
Yeah.
Disco Inferno and Buff Bagwell was up next. One of the producers in the truck found this attractive woman with big boobs, and Disco found her as well.
Disco definitely goes right. I thought she was a plant.
She might have been. She certainly had two plants.
Definitely had two plants. But then I was like, there's no one around her. Like, I was like, I'm like looking at, like there's like a guy, like, peeling away behind her, like trying to get away from her. I'm like, does she have a friend with her or a boyfriend? Or
it's
or
hilarious. If you go back and watch the 98, if you watch the 98 Starcade, and this was not a plant. It was honestly like they found Stacy Keibler in the crowd as like a hot chick.
Oh, yeah.
And she's wearing like a Wolfpack shirt. And she was just there as a fan.
Do you want me to bring it down to a much more manageable Toronto level?
Oh, go for it.
Sarah Taylor, former VJ at Much Music, was discovered in the crowd.
Really?
Yeah, she was there for a taping of MOD. And a producer was like,
I thought you were going to say she was at a wrestling event. No. And Much saw her and said, hey,
you should
bet
come
she
work
can
at,
transfer over here very
nicely.
You
can work at this music station. I'm going to say you're not going to get scouted for very many on-camera jobs at a wrestling event.
No, probably not. But this woman, I'm surprised, didn't show up the next night as part of Savage's Savagely Entourage.
Yeah, well, they were actually pretty good workers compared to some of the people on this show.
Oh, no doubt. You know, like believe me, Savage's Entourage consisted of two workers that were ahead of two in the ring,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
I will add Disco Inferno and Buff Bagwell to the Scott Putski list.
Yeah.
Buff Bagwell, extremely pronounced here. Schiavone lists off the sports credentials and then yells at Heenan for interrupting him. He is just bound and determined to get off these baseball stats for Buff
Bagwell.
That's
like high school baseball.
Yeah.
How old is this guy? 18? Like, he came into wrestling right at age?
He started in WCW
young,
at like
right?
20, yeah, true, 21. Actually. He was really young at this time.
Didn't go to that university or he could have learned that, you know.
Yeah. Shane McMahon. Extremely high on Buff Bagwell. He thought this guy was going to be the next big thing.
Well, there goes my thing about loving Shane McMahon as a worker.
Oh, yeah. One of the underrated talents.
No, I'm the one who defends him. Don't you remember? Like, you guys have.
Oh, I know. I know.
I think he's like, you know, he's a worker's worker.
So, defend Shane McMahon to me without bringing up a match with Kurt Angle.
I can't. But no, I okay. What's that other one where he climbs super high and does that insane?
He could fall off high shit, like, and I give him the most respect
you,
in the world.
As a company at that time whose target demographic was 18-year-old males, I think falling off high shit.
He was the perfect, like, for your fan that has your non-fan, it's like, hey, watch this. He was a YouTube clip before the technology existed.
Well, exactly, and I think that's one of those things where, you know, like, I don't, yeah, and this is going to sound like sacrilege because he walks on water, but Bruno Sammartino would not be as big today as he was back then. Like, if he came out today, same skill set, same unbelievable skill set, it wouldn't, people just aren't into what they're into. Like, earnestness and stuff like that, it's just not as popular as it was.
It's such a different business, a different audience that it's
whereas,
just,
like, Shane McMahon, for the time, was
a
good worker.
I don't know if he could have headlined in the 70s.
No, he definitely
would. Oh, I thought you were going to say he could have fit his
generation. No, he would have. Oh, my God, no. No, I'm just saying for that time period where, like, you can – indicated by this show and even a little later, you had so many great workers and you had so many terrible workers that his ability to kind of get over.
That
I think.
That one stunt that Shane did, I think it was SummerSlam with Steve Blackman, where he climbs to the top.
Oh my God.
It's not just the height of the fall, but he does it falling backwards.
Backwards.
I don't give a fuck how many cushions are at the bottom of that. No way I could do that.
I can't believe I
couldn't fall forwards, much less backwards. And where you don't even know when the point of impact is coming. Like that was like a 30-foot drop.
Oh my God. And I like it's a height where I'd be worried about wind, you know, like what if the wind blows me into the audience and I die, like, yeah. Especially having seen that New Jack, who's that New Jack?
Vic Grimes.
The
XPW one.
Where he tries to murder him.
That was insane.
And like being like, that's how easy it could happen. You know, like that's how easy this could go wrong.
It's interesting. Like, you know, obviously Hell in a Cell gets brought up with Foley and Undertaker, and Foley was on with Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez last week. And he talked about the fact that he didn't go up on top of the cage earlier. And it was like, you know, from the ground up, it was like, I can pull this off. But when he was up there,
oh, it looks so...
he was like, I didn't want to do this.
Yeah.
Like, but he's like, I might die here, but I got to go through with the spot. That's pretty nuts to be in that kind of mentality where you're up there. I'd be like, you know what, Taker, we're going to do something else.
Yeah, like on a much more minor level. Like some nights you'll be like looking at a stage when I'm like going to jump off and I'm like, that's not that high. And then it comes time to jump off and I'm like, sit down first and kind of lower myself down because I'm like, if I jump off this, I'm probably going to break my ankle when I land, you know? So it's just like, yeah, like it totally seems different when you're up there realizing you're going to be hurtling off it.
When we watched you at the Great Hall a couple of months ago, my God, was this pit was like, me and Way are like up in the second,
oh, the I saw you guys the balcony, yeah.
And we're just watching this and like, there's got to be some kind of like unwritten agreement when these guys are up there that, you know, you're going to catch people. This one dude like just jumped up and went head first down and it's like no one caught him. And I don't know how he landed. I was like, holy shit.
I've seen like there have been some gnarly ones. Like,
yeah, you must have seen
people jumping into pillars.
Oh,
like head first into a pillar and stuff.
Fuck.
I think the thing is, though, the vast majority of people are there looking out for you. So if you fall,
you would hope so, but there's always some assholes that are going to be like, fuck him.
Like, I find the hardest moshers are also the ones that will make sure you're not dead.
You know? Well, that's good to know.
But that also, like, it's some cities you go to, like, we went to Boston, played a show in Boston, some kid jumped and landed on my neck, and I'm like,
ooh.
I just heard all these cracks. I'm like, is this going to be like a thing, like Taz, where I walk back, and then all of a sudden my neck goes out once I get back to the back room or something, or, you know?
And then we'd have the Damien Abraham, like, Desire video with, like, Creed. The Damien Abraham's Road to Recovery.
Yeah, exactly.
His big comeback.
Versus Sabu. Sabu, sorry.
How we got into this discussion from Disco Inferno and Buff Bagwell. Right, sports credentials for Bagwell. Early on, Bagwell goes for his blockbuster, but Disco avoids it, and he bails to the floor. Disco gets the advantage. They're playing up Bagwell's neck injury. One of the more gruesome live sports injuries I've ever seen, when Rick Steiner delivered a bulldog to this guy off the second rope on an edition of Thunder, and Bagwell's head fell out of his like armpit and just snapped on the back of Rick Steiner. And this aired live, and it was just very gruesome to watch, and the guy legitimately like broke his neck from this on live television, but did make his comeback here. And Schiavone, during this match, during a low point, just gives a shout out to all of the wrestling fans in high school that have graduated this week.
Yeah, he's the worst. He is the worst announcer ever.
I think that at times, too, it's like the product also does somewhat affect your opinion of an announcer. When it became like this period, like I found Schiavone and Heenan to be really, really tough to enjoy. Yeah. And it was also they were calling a much worse product than they were 2 years earlier. You know what I mean? And I think that certainly affects people. Like, I don't think anyone, you know, when they look back at Bobby Heenan, are really going to talk about all his great WCW commentary, where he really was someone that he admitted it. When he went to WCW, it was a job right away.
Yeah.
And he didn't enjoy it as much, even during the peak.
I think also the thing is everyone gets burnt out and everyone gets
off time. And that's true. Imagine doing these 5 hours a week for these guys. They were doing three for Nitro, two for Thunder.
And like, and being in front of a live microphone that much, you're going to sound like an idiot a lot. I'm in front of a live microphone now, and I sound like an idiot a lot. But like,
and it's also when you're doing that much, and you're trying to keep a certain level of quality, it's like you do find yourself forcing yourself into formulas almost where you get into that.
Well, the last thing they're going to want to do after they watch wrestling every day like that is go home and watch tape and like learn like move names and learn like stuff that, you know, like, so it's like no wonder that they sound uninformed. It's because they're just calling it as they see it every time.
Here's we shit on Shivani for congratulating some kids on graduating high school. Disco hit an
I think it also speaks to who the target demographic was then, is like kids graduating high school, going to university. Like
then,
that was.
And then having a big Great American Bash post graduation party.
Well, but like when I went to first year university in 99, there were kids having Monday Night Raw viewings.
Oh,
like,
dude,
it
absolutely.
Was in England, and dude, it was like 3 in the morning.
At this time, I mean, those Nitro parties were going on, which was always a brilliant idea by WCW, doing those Nitro parties. And Monday nights became like a huge thing. Like, I remember during this summer in particular, like, I would get together a bunch of buddies and we would watch Raw on Monday
now
nights.
Now would be, WWE would be like, congratulations to all the kids graduating elementary school. Good luck next year at junior
You're probably
high.
Not awake at this hour to watch.
Like, good thing your parents have PVR'd this and made sure there's not any content that's inoffensive for you.
Disco hit his finish, the last dance, which was the stunner, on the floor, but Bagwell was able to break the count coming in. Bagwell went for his Macarena pile driver about 4 years past
the Macarena.
Los Del Mar releasing this hideous song.
Everything he does is so bad. Like, his entrance is so bad. Like, that weird strut thing. It just looks, like, so obnoxious.
Disco ducks another blockbuster as Bagwell fakes coming off the ropes, but then hits it on his second attempt and gets the win. 10 minutes and 36 seconds for a match where this was really like a pivotal point for Bagwell, where there was at this time, like, he was really being focused upon as being this guy they were going to elevate. This match really didn't do it for me in terms of, okay, this guy is ready for that jump to the main event, which they were teasing at
And
this time.
Almost like as they're de-pushing Disco Inferno, right? Because he had that run there where he was like the head of the Red and Black Wolf Pack for a minute, or he was like high up.
I always took this guy as just comedy.
I always thought it was a comedy thing, but it was like they were almost like what they did with Eric Young a couple years ago, where
right.
they made him serious for a while. They made Disco kind of serious for a minute there. Wasn't that just before this?
Yeah, he was involved in this.
Yeah.
He was part of that finish with Goldberg losing his streak.
Yeah.
Remember, he hit a run-in during that, the main event of Starrcade.
Look where he is now.
Yes. We got a video on the rap versus country music angle, which was highlighted by Conan's fashion here with a FUBU shirt.
Yeah, and even Ray's fashion.
Oh, man. They would have lots of that at the time. And then
Ray looks like he's 10, too. Like,
yes. Fairness is what he looks like.
Well,
now.
This is the unmasked Rey Mysterio.
Yeah, this was just a few months after they unmasked him.
And it's like still to this day, like when people look back on biggest blunders in wrestling history, it's like XFL. Demasking Rey Mysterio, Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Someone was like, okay, whatever masks we don't sell now with Rey Mysterio, what if we sold gas masks?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I thought they were coming out with bongs, those gas mask bongs that you get in Amsterdam at head shops.
I thought it was a social commentary on this pay-per-view.
maybe this thing's fucking stink.
But before that, someone who literally has not entered my mind in 13 years, 14 years, WCW hired an in-house DJ at the time, DJ Ran.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to figure out if this guy is actually a well-known DJ.
I don't know. I Googled him after, and it was like, I'm sure he's done, like,
other
some
things,
stuff.
Like,
but
radio,
like,
probably.
But, like, I found, like, some interview with him where it's like, you know, 10 years after WCW went out of business, and they're interviewing DJ Ran about what his thoughts on were, what went wrong with WCW. It's like, yeah, let's ask the in-house DJ, what were the problems with WCW? I'm sorry if I don't take your thoughts with too much more than a grain of salt. But anyway, he's just getting Baltimore ready for this. And this was like this was a time when WCW was throwing 10 million things at the wall, and having a DJ in there, I mean, I wasn't opposed to this. It was whatever.
I wasn't opposed to it, but it was like one more person like that has to comment, like one more narrator of the story, you know. And
they had a host too on Nitro for a brief time at this. His name was like Ricky Ratchman or something like that. And
was it the guy from Headbangers Ball?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, whoa.
They used him for like a couple of weeks during this time as well. It's like I always remember the spring of 99 where it was like all these ideas. And to me, it was like even at this point, it was like WWF felt like the cool company, and WCW just felt like they were like some old guys that were trying to resonate with a young audience.
And I think the other problem is they didn't stick with anything. You know, like it's like everything that gets an audience has to grow. You know, like in that, and like even look at WWE, like Austin, giving the 316 promo wasn't like the next day everyone had a shirt on. You know, like it takes a while for something to build. And that was the thing about WWE is they were so desperate they were forced to kind of like wait.
And you know what was also peculiar here was that I can't remember if it was I think he was filming a movie at this time, but it was like you had no recollection Bill Goldberg was,
where was Goldberg?
Part of the roster here. And it's like
I thought he was injured maybe or something.
I think he was filming a movie at this time because this was before he put his arm through that limo.
Oh, that's before the limo.
The glass that he demanded not be gimmicked. Amazing. But I
I've
mean,
made that same demand to someone.
Goldberg was every bit the star Austin was at this time.
Yeah.
And that is what WCW had in their back pocket throughout this whole time was Bill Goldberg.
Yeah, they never really – I don't know. Like I was thinking about this the other day. Like what an amazing storyline to have when NWO's coming in. You know, NWO takes over the company. And you have a veteran who goes off to be reborn. You have a mid-carder who rises to fight the challenge when no one else is around in Diamond Dallas Page. And then you have this new monster. And the three of these guys should have come in, and the three of them should have destroyed the company. And then you have the three of them fight. And then you build up from there. It's like it's such an amazing natural storyline. Like it's just such like a perfect like triumvirate. But they still never – you watch like it almost builds to that and then falls apart. Like that moment where Sting – saves DDP from NWO. It's like that's when it all falls apart.
That Starrcade 97 show, it was like it was such a high point and at the same time such a low point for them as well. I get sad when I look back at WCW and what could have been.
Oh, it's insane to think there's
no reason that company shouldn't have been
around.
If
it wasn't a wrestling company, there would have been a big documentary into this company by now. Like if it had been a film company that had gone from that successful to gone. Bankrupt, bought by their almost out of business competition a few years earlier. That'd be a major movie. Like if that was like a film studio that had done that, like it's just crazy to think that this company was so in the black, so much in the black. And now
98, they were the time the most profitable wrestling company in history.
Like
that year 98, and then 2 years later, they're losing $60 million a year, and that's. You know, everyone just looks at, well, Jamie Kellner, he didn't want wrestling and it was doomed no matter what. And it's like, really? Because if I look at the profit and losses sheet and I see minus $60 million, that's kind of swaying my decision versus a company that's profitable. Like, had Kellner come in 98, you think he's canceling Nitro and Thunder?
Well, it's like no one sells Interscope when Interscope has the number one record, you know?
Yeah.
Like, no one's like looking to unload that property when it's like when they're the number one in the charts. It's when they've got a controversial kind of secondary artist that people want. sorry.
We had all these empty seats in the front row, which in 2000 was a regular occurrence, but in WCW 99, this was kind of different. As Master P and the No Limit Soldiers came out for the next match, just to, in case you weren't sure something was going to happen in this match.
And they get entrance music.
Yes.
And Tony Schiavone, Mike Tenay continues his infomercial. Like, they paid him, and then they also gave him a bunch of free advertisement for his career.
So we had Kurt Hennig and Bobby Duncum Jr. This was shortly after they had released the Rap is Crap song, which took on a life of its own. Like, there were radio stations playing this. I mean, this is, to me...
I have to say, though, not the most original phrases. I'm sure it was uttered by every grandparent throughout the 80s prior to this.
Crap.
Rap is crap. Rap, more like crap.
And then taking on Conan and Ray, who, as we mentioned, came out wearing gas masks. And
a good feud, though. Kind of like a great setup for a feud, too. Like,
Yeah. I mean, Conan and Rey Mysterio were legitimate. Oh. Like, for that audience that they were going after, I mean, these were two characters that audience really enjoyed and resonated
and
with.
I think Conan
was super over at this point.
And he's still, like, he was like, and that's like a gimmick that should be super annoying. You know, when Road Dogg did kind of the same sort of, like, Barker before the match starts thing, it got really annoying. But I think Conan's always a guy that finds a way to change it up slightly enough but keep it in the same realm that it always was like, yeah, this guy's cool.
Yeah. I just it's hard to watch a Conan promo without like a boom at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. Boom. Ornan ran.
Did you celebrate this Conan match by taking a trip?
Believe me, I was well into Iran. I was like four or five cookies into Iran and several light forays in the glass plane into Iran. I think that's the other thing now. Like maybe we're going to see the coming out of the closet of the marijuana wrestler, which has been very much relegated to the closet because of Vince McMahon. But now RVD's coming back to the Fed. Can't imagine he's like, you know, not going to partake. Is he just going to eat the fines? Or as WWE said, because you have a medical exemption, we're going to give you the
maybe
right
he'll get a marijuana use exemption. If you can get one for testosterone, I don't see why.
Well, apparently
you can get one
UFC is now going to allow marijuana. It's not, they've taken off the banned substance list.
Apparently. Oh, what they've done is
up the cannabinoids that you can have in your system.
Exactly. You can go from, it used to be if you had like 50 nanograms per milliliter, then you'd get docked.
Yeah.
But now when the UFC is overseeing shows like overseas, it's now up to 150. So
yeah.
Had you smoked, you know, a couple of days ago,
you would be okay.
Essentially, they want to catch you if like it's been in relatively close proximity. But if you smoke 3 weeks out, you're going to be okay, essentially, yeah. is what
So we
saying.
Still will not have the great Diaz smoke out before
well,
a pay-per-view.
When Diaz failed his first pot test in 2007, even under the new guidelines, he would have failed.
Oh, yeah.
He was over 150for that fight against
Takanori Gomi. The best quote ever in mixed martial arts is his one about...
Is marijuana getting in the way of your fighting?
No.
Like, marijuana. Fighting's getting in the way of my marijuana.
I'm like, wow, that guy is a... But anyway, but like RVD and Conan, I think maybe we're going to see the coming out of the weed pothead wrestler.
Perhaps. AAA and WWE leading the way.
What's the guy? There's also a guy in the JCW that has like a weed man gimmick.
Yes.
So, you know, not that they're the first people. JCW being the leaders in the industry once again.
Today, as Damian was mentioning here, stating that he made over $60 million last year. If ever there's, you know, that kind of thread that really gets a fan behind a baby face, it's knowing their net worth.
They're really, really rich.
They have more money than you can dream of.
But you know what? That I would say that too, but it does. Like, look at, people love the Kardashians. People love Paris Hilton. People love, like, Kanye West. Like, multi-millionaires that are completely unrelatable, like have money that is completely unrelatable to the average person.
I guess so. Match began. The West Texas Rednecks here actually got some pretty good heat. I found like the crowd was into this match.
He, Mr. Perfect, and this is a cool gimmick, you know, like it doesn't play everywhere and maybe not at this time, but like young people would probably naturally go behind the cool new young music and older people would kind of go behind the older music.
That was the hope when they did this.
Yeah, and I thought, and also Mr. Perfect is just so good.
He was so good in this role that it was like people just got behind this guy.
And he just knows how to work. Like every single thing he does in this match makes you like be like, oh.
And he was one of a handful of guys. It was like you could see like they came over to WCW and you really saw like the kind of, they just coasted for a while, mm-hmm. and there were a number of guys. But this storyline, you could tell like Hennig was really invigorated with this because this was something he could get into rather than just, you know, I'm the random guy in the NWO black and white. You know what I mean?
I think it's also awesome that you have this visual of this big, muscular wrestler beating the shit out of a little kid for most of the match.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Ray is an amazing baby face.
Ray is
a
tremendous
sort of Mexican
baby face.
You know, yeah.
Should never
have. Lucha Libre style.
This guy should never be a heel, in my opinion.
Never. Ever be a heel unless it's like
it should be something
you
great.
Build him to like he's like the biggest baby face, like the most sympathetic, and then you turn him just to, you know, but you're right, like he's such a natural.
Duncan hit Mysterio with a power bomb, beat him down as Master P here was just jumping up and down. He was very excited here, at least earning his 200 grand. It was like 80 grand a jump.
Yeah, I was gonna say each of those jumps was not very, you know, that's a pretty penny to earn for getting up and out of your seat.
There was this one spot where Mysterio was like seated in the corner, and then Kurt Hennig went and like sat on his head like he was taking a shit on him or something. Do you notice this? What was this?
I thought it was like compressing the spine because he was like working him.
Yeah,
in the
maybe
neck, in the back.
It would hurt
stuff,
if you put all your weight on a guy's head.
Oh yeah, my finishing move in high school, or when I say high school wrestling, I make it sound like I was actually doing Greco-Roman, but like when you're fighting with your friends, it's like. A running jump onto their back, just like on their shoulders. So I can only imagine if I added the head in there.
Oh, when you said just wrestling there, I went from imagining you in a singlet on a mat in the gym to outside putting a guy through a table with like an attitude adjustment.
Actually, one time at my friend's house, who lived like on Greenwood Avenue, right? Like a busy street.
Yeah.
We got into a wrestling match outside, like a hardcore, you know, this is circa 2000, with garbage cans. I'm smashing him with a garbage can in the ring. It's half real, half fake, you know, type thing.
I used to be able to throw a great work punch, I found.
Really? I probably could throw a great work punch. I don't think I'd throw a really good real punch. You know, but I can take a ton of abuse.
Oh, there you go. That's the key. You got a good chin on you.
That was the thing. I was like telling CM Punk, like, can you give me a chop? And he's like, I could. Your company would sue me.
Yeah, that's actually a policy now. They don't let their talent touch people.
But I was like, I'm not saying I could survive a go to sleep if you really did it, but I think I could survive a chop.
A shoot go to sleep in a fight. That'd be awesome. Can you imagine seeing a street fight ending like that?
I would, if you could do real wrestling moves, that's why I love that one MMA fight every year where there's like one move or two moves in a UFC card where there's like, you're like, oh my God, like the
German suplex
kick,
will come out.
Yeah, like where you're like, maybe they will. Like maybe it's only a few more years before someone's going off the top of the cage.
Yep, there was an Enziguri by Eve Edwards.
Yeah, I remember what was the running cage kick?
Where Benson Henderson and Anthony Pettis hitting that.
Incredible. Like where you're just like, this is like Bloodsport. This is what it was like when Van Damme did it in TV.
Anthony Pettis says he's been working on this like 720 degree kick that he can hit in like mid ring, and he's going to try it in some fight.
Oh my God.
I love that this shit's getting developed now.
The guys are working on this. And that's really the only way it can go, because everyone's gotten to the point where, you know, everyone can kind of like have good defense, and everyone, I guess, can get people in keep it where you score points. It's like guys are just going to start doing flair moves. Like, I don't mean flair and Ric Flair moves, I mean, but like moves where everyone's just like blown away by them.
Match continues here with they got the heat on Mysterio. He eventually tags Conan. The ref doesn't see it. Crowd boos. Then Mysterio finally kicks Hennig away to make the legal tag, and Conan comes in. Face buster. Mysterio hits the Bronco Buster to Hennig, and then a Hurricane Rana by Mysterio to dunk him. And then out of nowhere, Barry Windham runs in to help out the heels. And there's one run in where it's like, this was Windham joining the group. It was like you had no reservations about which side he was assisting here.
When there's also like, it's every match now has had a screw job finish, right?
Bagwell and Disco, I guess.
Oh, yeah, that a clean.
But,
Other thing. And also my ECW account gets another one, I guess, too.
Oh, that's right. So there was this...
two. Conan worked.
Yep, Conan, Mysterio. Yeah. They both worked at ECW. So Windham runs in to help the heels. Swole then levels Duncan with the shoulder block. The shoulder block that was apparently 8 years in the making. Yeah,
the $400,000 shoulder block.
And then Mysterio hits a springboard dropkick to get the win at 10:45, and then there's this giant brawl afterwards with the No Limit Soldiers and the West Texas Rednecks. It's like 10-on-3 for the babyfaces.
Yeah, and also the security looks more extreme than anyone else in the ring. That's that dude who was always doing WCW. Maybe he wasn't always doing it, but he just stood out when I saw him. He had like a purple braided ponytail, but a shaved head otherwise.
Yes. And in fine WCW form, the springboard drop kick that Mysterio hit for the finish was missed by the camera. So that was all great. And then the heels hogtied Conan and Rey Mysterio as the crowd was half and half for them.
Yeah, it was. It was a real, I guess it would be a Zeb Coulter kind of crowd.
Yeah, I don't know if you're going to see Zeb Coulter tie up two Mexicans.
No.
I don't know how
that's what happens when you respond to that angle. When you subtle play the racism like they did with this rap is crap angle, you get away with a lot more than when you overtly play up the racism in the Zeb Coulter angle.
So if you're asking who is Swole, Mike Tenay informed us that he played in the CFL for the Edmonton Eskimos and was also part of the bodybuilding world, not mentioning that he was a cousin of Master P.
No, he did. They said he was a cousin. I think at the very beginning, maybe. No, sorry. They didn't say the Edmonton Eskimos. They said he played for the NFL team, and they said he also played in the CFL.
Okay. I don't think he played in the NFL.
I thought they said he was. Oh no, maybe they mentioned reference. Okay, forget it.
Well, he said NFL.
He did NFL.
I just don't know if that's a legit fact.
Okay,
that's all.
Maybe he got to a training camp. He played in the NFL like his cousin played in the NBA.
Of course. So the pay per view. We're three matches in. It's time for a Horace Hogan match.
Yeah, it's time for. He's like the one wrestler that I've watched like all this Japanese stuff because he was in FMW. And I still don't have a soft spot for him at all.
He is, I don't know, it's like El Hijo del Santo right now. His son has started wrestling.
Oh, really?
And he's sent him to Japan, and he's not allowed to use the Santo name until he gets to a certain level. And, you know, you watch Horace Hogan, and it's like, I understand this logic.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you got to be worthy of the name.
Of the name of the – well, yeah, especially –
say what you will about Hulk Hogan. I mean, certainly a star. And Horace here, not a star.
No, Hogan should have given that to Luger. Lex Hogan.
So Ernest Miller comes out with Sonny Ono, and he was supposed to take on Scott Norton, who apparently was not cleared to wrestle during this match because he had high blood pressure.
Oh, really? That's because they were saying he's just not here. Right?
That is according to an old Observer I found that actually I had an Observer recapping this show.
That must have been the only wellness thing on this entire card.
It should also, it is perfectly fine if you also are aware of the fact that Scott Norton was going to be losing this match. And that's how some of these guys thought at the time. I can't imagine, I kind of enjoy like the old school workers who it's like, would come up with something like that to get out of doing a job. Like, whereas like today it's like, man, you don't really imagine like young up and comers like having that mentality. Like well,
someone would never be on TV.
Yeah.
You know, like if not for losing, would we ever get to see Cesaro?
Yeah, right, very true. Yeah. Horace comes out instead of Scott Norton complaining about
if I'm Scott Norton and someone in my and I'm a wrestler like Scott Norton and my boss his karate teacher, my old boss's karate teacher is going to beat me. I'd be pissed.
And this was at the time, I think Scott Norton was the IWGP champion because he was doing stuff with New Japan at the time. So I can see his logic somewhere.
I'm just going to go back to Japan. We're still doing good. It's still the 90s.
So anyway, Horace comes out. Apparently he was attacked by a crowbar, not Devin Storm, the actual crowbar, by the Cat and Sonny Ono. And he says, there's nothing more that people want to see than Horace Hogan beating up Ernest Miller. Miller says, no, I want to face Scott Norton. And he cuts a promo on going to get a karate gi and beating up these people in the crowd.
Everyone in the crowd.
So Horace then insinuates, you can't even beat yourself, if you know what I mean. You can't even masturbate.
Was he high?
He could have been.
Because I was like watching this thing. I'm like, is he stoned?
Who is the babyface in this?
That's what I was also trying to figure out. Like, who's like meant to be the good guy?
It was like each guy was trying to out-heal the other. But and it was like, Cap felt he was losing this, so he told the audience, I could beat up all of you.
I think it was like one of these things where they never said, like, they always would say, it's hard to see who's going to be the fan favorite in this one. Like, about every match, they were saying that. Because everyone, like, no one's a good guy, no one's a bad guy. Everyone's just like this like chaotic neutral character, to use some D&D parlance for everyone out there.
We should also mention going into this pay-per-view is like pretty much none of these undercard matches were announced ahead of time. So they were all like thrown together like the day of. So it's not like you had any build for some of these matches here. They were just aimlessly put together. Miller hit him with this giant like mule kick and then tosses Horace to the floor where Sonny Ono starts attacking Horace. Miller then Irish whips him into the guardrail, hits a low blow. And Tony Schiavone says, this match has been pretty brutal. To which Bobby Heenan says, all of Cat's matches are pretty brutal. I love this commentary duo. Miller then takes a back body drop to the floor, and Sonny Ono opens his briefcase and places a red slipper onto Ernest Miller's foot, and then behind the referee's back, kicks Horace with the red slipper, removes the shoe, and pins Horace at 5 minutes and 10 seconds. And then Sonny Ono puts the cape on Miller as he dances, and Horace attacks him as the announcers pretty much ignore this post-match attack and just say, we're moving on, even if they're not. Dreadful match.
Dreadful match. Dreadful match between, like, you know, I was going to say I could not think of a card in wrestling I would care about less than a Horace Hogan Ernest the Cat Miller match, but I do think a Disco Inferno Buff Bagwell match is pretty high up there too for my least cared about wrestling match of all time.
Well, it seemed that, you know, some companies foster this environment of everyone trying to top each other. They were certainly doing that in WCW, but kind of in reverse of like, okay, I can outdo that shit match.
I can coast.
And Ric Flair, I think he was going to try in this next one.
Yeah.
We got a video on Ric Flair and Roddy Piper. They state in the video that Piper is the WCW president, and part of the basis for this feud was Piper slamming Ric Flair's financial situation.
I know, that was the best part. He's like, Roddy Piper's like, you can't even keep your finances in order. How are you supposed to run WCW? It's nice to know that something's never changed for Flair. Like, his body might have gone, he might not be able to wrestle anymore, but he still has real problems.
It's like you got this
finances.
Idea that it was like, okay, well, what am I doing in my promo tonight? It's like, just go out there. You got a feud with Flair. It's like, this to me is like the counter argument to people who say you shouldn't have scripted promos and do bullet points. It's like, sometimes you can give guys too much leeway. And this is the shit we get. It's like a rambling Roddy Piper and just going crazy. Anyway, Dean Malenko and Chris Benoit were part of this as they had broken away from Flair and the Horsemen. Flair had turned heel. It was actually Ric Flair that was the president of WCW at the time. So He is introduced as such, and he comes out with Arn Anderson and WCW's answer to China by a woman named Asia, A-S-Y-A. Right down to that Y.
I know. And she's not even that big. Like, she's muscular, but, like, you know.
Well, she was named Asia because, you know, China. She encompasses China, which could have been the basis for one of her pictures later on.
Well, who knows? What's Asia up to these days?
That's a great question. Do you want to find out what Asia's up to? Do you want to do an interactive game here? I don't even know what this woman's name was.
Christy
Wolf was her name. An American bodybuilder, model, and former pro wrestler. She's best known for her stint in WCW. It's all about her WCW career. Retirement. Soon after her release, Wolf retired from wrestling, began to perform in barrel racing.
Whoa.
In addition to resuming her career as a bodybuilder and model, Wolf graduated with a degree in biotechnology and married Dale Torborg in October of 2000. Dale Torborg, who played the Kiss Demon WCW.
That's a good. Oh, wow.
Look at that.
Well, and people say nothing came out of WCW. True love.
Wow, look at that. Dale Torborg in Asia. I think I knew that somewhere. All right. Ric Flair and Roddy Piper for control of WCW. Piper comes and he is billed from the mountains of Oregon. And he comes out without a shirt and, dare I say, another Scott Putski nominee.
A lot. I was going to say, he looked pretty good.
For a guy who we saw a couple of years later who would have, like, the belly and such, in 1999, guy, you can't knock his commitment to at least looking the part.
There must have been, like, a little bit of a dispenser back there in the locker room.
I can definitely say there was. They exchanged chops at the start with Piper landing the majority just... Flair doing his Flair flop. Piper grabbed his balls. There was a shoving match with Randy Anderson. I mean, it was just, Piper's offense just looked so weak, and Flair oversold it. This was just such an awkward match to get into. At one point, Arn Anderson attacked Piper on the floor. Piper grabs Flair's trunks. It was like all of Ric Flair's.
He looked like the Coppertone baby.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous discrepancy in color.
Super bright white ass. Like, it's like if you have, like, if it was an old TV, it would probably blow your.
Like, I think an airplane could land if this ass was on the runway. Flair was just doing all these shortcut spots in this. Loves showing that ass off throughout his career. Piper decks Arn on the floor, hits a sunset flip, which was the biggest struggle of a sunset flip you will see.
Yeah.
Onto Flair. Then there is a sleeper applied by Piper, but Flair gets off. Flair then grabs these knucks that Arn passes to him, clocks Piper, only gets a two count, then applies a figure four as Arn assists here, helping him, when Buff Bagwell runs down, attacks Arn Anderson, and then starts attacking Ric Flair for the DQ at 8 minutes and 17 seconds. So Bagwell, to try and assist Roddy Piper, ran in, costing Piper the presidency, which in storyline was supposed to hand him the ball.
So I was wondering, when Piper gets mad now and beats the crap out of Buff Bagwell, is he swerving on him or is he mad that he's cost him the match?
A great question, Damien, and more thought than most probably gave WCW at the time.
I was watching him.
This made no sense if you're Buff Bagwell, and completely justified that Piper would be pissed at this guy for costing him the presidency.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. Like, Piper would be reasonable to be upset, but then also, you know, he lets Flair leave, and he starts beating the shit out of him with the strap.
So,
and, like, they're both holding him down. Like, so were Flair and Piper in on it the whole time? That's why the match was shitty? Because they've been working in cahoots?
That was it. They were trying to work.
They were trying to work
here.
A shitty match. So
because coming out of this was a Piper heel turn that we witnessed.
So,
and then Piper
weird.
Became his vice president and would be referred to as RPVP, Roddy Piper Vice President.
That's like my PCP show.
This was when Phantom Menace came out. And
they also said, when someone came out earlier, I'm trying to remember who.
I think Piper called his hands Phantom and Menace.
Yeah, this is Phantom. No, he said this is Phantom and this is Menace about Benoit and Malenko.
Oh, my goodness.
These are my buddies. This is Phantom and this is Menace. It's like, yo, no one liked that movie when it came out. You should try to disassociate yourself from that movie as soon as it hit.
I had a friend in high school who, it would have been like this exact time period when Phantom Menace came out. Camped out for 3 days to see that piece of shit.
I camped out the first day.
Really?
Yeah, my friend's like, with 8 hours.
Did you, after watching it, did you try to, like, justify the wait? The movie was fine, man.
It was a surreal moment where everyone's like, well, I guess I'll see you in, like, 4 years when the next one comes out, or 2 years. And then, but then everyone's just like, no one's excited. Aaron's just like, kind of like, what was, like, maybe we didn't get it. Maybe we waited too long, you know? Excuse me. Some people got back in line and saw it again.
Wow.
You know, and we're like,
I gotta watch it again, man.
The best reaction though, have you ever heard of Starroids, I think it's called? It's a documentary about fans in Australia at a convention. And it's just before Phantom Menace comes out. And the head of the Australian fan club sees the movie at the screening, comes out and resigns as the head of the fan club.
He's like, I
just cannot be with, I don't longer have faith in Star Wars to lead this anymore and stuff, and like resigns. It's like,
there was that Hot Docs film a few years ago, I Hate You, George Lucas.
Oh, really?
It's really good.
Oh, because he I think he now kind of goes with it a little bit.
Oh, totally. Like, you know? He gave this documentary, like,
consent.
They got footage in this documentary. It was like, he's fine with.
I think, but you know what? That to me must be a PR stunt.
Absolutely.
You know, I was thinking that with Metallica, too. Like, Metallica now, it's like, they're so cool. Like, there was one day on that tour where we're just, like, sitting out there, and then, like, Metallica's just eating with us. Like, normally, like, they'd have, you know, catering in the back, like, you know, but there's James Hetfield just eating with people, like, in the catering thing. And it's like, I started thinking, it's like, wow, they were, like, the most hated band, the most vilified band, 2000, 2001. And it's like, they've kind of gone on this, like, we're going to do right by our fans ever since then. Like, ever since they went alternative and sued Napster fans and all that shit.
They could have turned that Napster thing around to their advantage. Instead, it's held as such a black mark against them.
It's going to be held for a black mark forever.
Which I feel, though, over time, though, I much more side with Metallica's side. In the grand scheme of things, I completely disagree with the way they went about it.
And I don't think anyone realized at the time that what we were seeing was not...
That was a dramatic shift.
Records are in trouble. We're seeing the death of content.
Yeah.
Like, it's a paradigm shift. And I think Metallica was trying to fight a paradigm shift because you're seeing books. Books aren't going to exist. Like, we still read books because we're raised with that nostalgia.
Yeah.
But, like, another generation, maybe even my kids.
Magazines and newspapers, gone. By the end of our lifetime, probably will be gone.
CD. Like, it's weird because it's like, I love all this stuff. Like, what am I going to look at when I walk around now at stores? Like, clothes? Like, coffee? I don't like that. You know? But that's, like, that's what's going to happen. You know? Like, we're really seeing that paradigm shift happen. And it's almost like you get this weird conspiracy theory, like this, once again, an insane digression. But, like, you want to undercut an economy, you destroy their production base, you know, like you get rid of the production base. And so, like, because that way they no longer have a means of justifying their own support, right? And so that's what you kind of did with musicians. Like, musicians can no longer sell records. And so what's become the financial support for these artists in place of records?
Yeah.
It's corporate sponsorship. Like, it's this Jay-Z thing. Like, this Jay-Z thing that people are talking about now, like, oh, wow, it's crazy. That's the tip of the iceberg. You wait. Like, if Billboard had said, we're going to count these, you would have seen a flood of artists doing these corporate records. But I just think it's a matter of time before like, hey, buy three cases of this soda, get the new One Direction record. Buy 10 cartons of this pork product, get the brand new fucked up record. Not the fucked up record, but you know, like some record, you know. And I really think that's kind of what happened with the MP3 stuff. And Metallica, I don't think they were cognizant of that at the time. I don't think anyone was. But that was the way they were going. They were just looking out for their interests.
As much as people criticize Metallica, it's like, how many artists today, had they known what the effects would have been, would have backed Metallica? And that was something. It was like, when Metallica attacked, it was like, really no one really stood with them of any note.
Yeah, no one did. But I think you couldn't have.
Because they got such negative publicity. It's like, how dare you take our free stuff away from us?
And, like, the thing is, a CD was not superior to a record. So that's why CDs never killed off a record. But an MP3, if you're not talking about fidelity, if fidelity's not an issue and you're not going to get into that argument, it is more convenient. You know, you got to move. You move your iPod. You got all your records. You know, iMove, it takes forever.
Sure.
Forever to move. You know, you lose your records. They're on a cloud. You download them all again. You know, I lose my records. I am devastated and my life falls apart. It's one of those weird things where Metallica was fighting a losing fight. But, you know, and they did lose.
As Kid Rock infamously said, what the fuck do I care? I'm rich.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, it's funny. Someone
said that on Much Music, I believe.
Oh, I remember when he said that on Much Music, on his, like, much Intimate and Interactive. But
do they still do those, Intimate and Interactive?
Yeah, they do. Well, not really. They've got a new name for them now.
Okay.
Live at Much.
Live at Much.
But they were so great. No, it doesn't sound as intimate. But it's like all that stuff at Much Music now, so many people do that format, you know, so you have to find a new format.
I think you should try and resurrect Electric Circus.
They brought back Electric Circus. New Year's and Halloween, they do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know what's crazy?
I used to fucking love that. When I was home on Fridays and just listening to those Euro tracks.
Do you remember JP, the floor director on that show?
No.
He was like an on-camera kind of person. He started as a dancer there, but now he's still the floor director of Much Music. I still see him all the time.
Really?
Yeah. Like I remember I never liked that music, but I loved watching Electric Circus. Like it was a fun show to watch because you'd watch kids. Like you'd be like, oh, look at those dudes. I can't believe they're down there.
See, I watched and enjoyed. You probably watched and were like making fun of these people.
I was, yeah, probably.
but let's be honest here.
But still, we both were entertained, you know?
I once went down. It was like 2000. I went there to watch a Green Day Intimate and Interactive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I went down. I met Iggy Pop interviewed – or Henry Rollins interviewed Iggy Pop, and I went and saw that. I went down.
Wow, Henry Rollins interviewing Iggy Pop. Yeah, that would have
like
been pretty cool.
Three people there, four people up front. Wow. Yeah, it was like –
Green Day was just insane packed for. I remember like, you know, everyone loved Green Day after Dookie, and I always – and then after that, it was like this big thing. It's like, no, Green Day sucks now. They suck. And I would always remain loyal to this group. And then it was like at 2000 when that record came out, and it was their warning album. And I went down to watch that expecting it to be like a small crowd because it's like I just listen to people around me who are into Green Day. And it was just like, wow, this group's pretty big.
I think that's the thing is like now we don't have –
and then Obama came around, and then they were set forever.
We don't have any more like a pervasive culture, right? Like in that, and that was the kind of the beginning of like seeing 2000 when the internet, when you could be a colossal fan of something and not be exposed to any other fans, but think it's the biggest thing in the world because everyone you associate with on the internet is only into that artist.
Yeah,
you know, and it's like you're not going to have another Nirvana or even another Green Day when Green Day first happened, but you're going to have like tons and tons of like little Nirvanas and tons of little Green Days and little things like that now because I think it's just – it's so much more tribal.
Yeah.
You know, you can find like your segment of people. Like if I was only
– it's never been easier to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, if I was only into one artist, I could find people that only want to talk about that one artist 24 hours a day, you know, because there's crazy people everywhere. And I think before – you would have to – like you would have friends around you or people around you that would be like, yo, you're getting a little too into Duran Duran. You better chill out on this Duran Duran thing. There's no one but people like – there's people probably telling these people like, hey, you're getting a little too into Katy Perry. But there's a million people on the internet that's like, you do not love her with your whole heart enough. You haven't killed for her yet. You know, like
you
that's –
haven't killed for her
that's like, but that's the thing now. You can go into these little like realms where these obsessive people can just fester and be obsessive. Like whereas before – you kind of had to still associate with people outside of your interests.
Man, it scares the fuck out of me to think what life will be like when we're like 60. You know what I
mean?
I feel I'll be so disassociated with like technology and just I'll have no comprehension of what's going on.
I think the thing is like we've been talking about things in terms of cycles. You know, like we talk about the wrestling cycle and we're like, you know, there's a lull and there's a boom.
I hope there's a regression in technology.
I don't think there ever might be.
I don't
see
how there could be. But I'd be down for
that. There might be. There's going to have to be a regression in access to people's information because people have put too much of themselves out there. But that being said, like people, I think what we're seeing is we're seeing the end of our era, the content era, where you bought content, you paid for content. Now
that's crazy though.
Content's going to
terrible for people like us.
Terrifying.
Work in television.
Scary,
or...
But like that's the thing is people still want information and entertainment, and people still need context. Is now figuring out a way to, okay, how do you get, you know, it's like that South Park episode with the little gnomes, the underwear gnomes, where
yes.
They're like, okay, A, underwear, C, profit. We just need to figure out B, right? And that's kind of where we're at now. People still want that information, like, but we just have these old ways of gauging it. Like, you look at ratings. Ratings are a perfect example. I don't think ratings really reflect people's tastes anymore.
No, like, no. I've always found, like, especially in wrestling, it's like people are way too sensitive to
ratings.
these artificial numbers that realistically, what does that mean of who's watching versus I would much rather, you know, look at other areas where people are spending money on your product. Mm-hmm. But it's like ratings are out the next day. They're instant and it's a result of something the night before.
And if you look at the pool of who ratings are, you can't work in media to be in ratings. You can't have someone in your family work in media. Like, it's very secretive, right?
Sure.
But it's also people that tend not to be the vanguard of technology, right? And the thing is now is we have so many people that are on the quote-unquote vanguard of technology. People have PlayStation 3s. People have computers. People have phones. People consume media in, like, so many different ways other than just through that ratings-producing cable box on the top of the TV. But the people that are reflected by that ratings producer cable box on the top of the TV are not necessarily the people that watch stuff on the internet. Like Game of Thrones. Like, remember that? Like, everyone's talking about that episode, Red Wedding. Like, everyone in the internet. Like, the internet exploded talking about it. But you look at the ratings, that thing did not rate. You know, it did well for HBO.
Sure.
But, like, you know, compared to, like, 2.5 Men,
yeah.
I've never heard anyone in a conversation talk about 2.5 Men. And, like, it's not like I'm just hanging out with people that are exactly like me. But, like, even on the subway, even, like, stuff like that, I see people that are not like me at all talking about other stuff.
Yeah.
That I watch too, you know, and it's like, well, why aren't these people being reflected? It's like, because these people are not necessarily watching Game of Thrones through the TV. Well, probably not through legal means, you know?
I think what we're getting closer to is like, that the want is still there from people out there. That's still, you know.
People love it.
You know, the day of a wrestling pay-per-view when people are searching for free streams or whatever, it's like, people want to see this thing. Mm-hmm. And to me, one of the keys that people will still spend for is convenience. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you have the option of, to me, it's like the Ring of Honor pay-per-view this past weekend. If I think spending $15 knowing that I'd get a quality stream, that would be great. I'm willing to spend money knowing that I'm going to get this product and it's going to be clean and it's going to be efficient. You know what I mean? If you're having a bunch of friends over to watch WrestleMania, it's like, do I really want to bother trying to find an illegal stream of this, or should I just spend $50 amongst the 8 of us and I don't have to worry about that shit?
Well, I think as a wrestling fan, you know, and this is more where I get affected by it, because a music fan, I don't care if someone illegally downloads my record, because it's like, I'm Matador cares. You know, maybe even people in my band care. I shouldn't say I'm speaking for everyone, but I don't care, because I don't think we would be here without the internet. You know, like, people be like, oh, do you think, you know, how many records do you think you would have sold without the internet? It's like, probably less than we're selling now, because people wouldn't have heard of us.
I get that, but it's like,
that being said, I think there, when you take that argument outside of that world and I put it to wrestling, which is somewhere where I'm a consumer, I'm not a producer, I have no vested interest. And I think, and you start looking at it, it's like, If you want, like, you bring it up on the show, and I think this is the best argument. If you are going to illegally download it and search it out, you've established that you want it.
There's a value to it.
So you've established that there's a value, that you want it. And I think the thing is with wrestling is, like, if you're not going to a show, if you're not paying for a pay-per-view, but you're still complaining about the ads on Raw, you know, when they do those stupid domino things on the pay-per-view, it's like, that's the alternative. It's like, okay, we can all have this. This could all be free. But the money's got to come from somewhere. And if you want to see, like, Ciampa come to the ring with, like, a giant Pizza Hut logo on his back and wrestle Matt Elgin, who's got a giant, like, you know, like, or whatever that auto wrecking company they make him endorse on Ring of Honor thing on his back, like, that's the alternative, because, like, this stuff isn't made for free, you know? And it's like, it's either comes from being paid for by fans, or it comes from being paid for by people with lots of money, which in our case and media is corporations.
And you just get back to, like, your band. Like, yes, you know, you're obviously thankful you have fans that have an interest in your product. At the same time, you're providing something for them that means something to them, and you turn around and go to, you know,
I think
Joe Random fan at his work and say, hey, man, just, you know, he works at a coffee shop. Give me some free coffee. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's stealing.
It's hard because, like, we're talking about information. Right? Like, if you don't want the physical product, if we're just talking about the – and then it's like – and the thing about this information argument is it goes – it's such a huge argument, because it goes to software. It goes to everything you – anything you're entertained by.
And it's easily – you can – if you want to take something for free, there's a million arguments you can make in your head to justify
absolutely. You can rationalize it. These guys are millionaires. These guys have this. These guys do that.
Yeah.
And I – you know, I'm not going to say that I've never illegally downloaded something. The stuff I'm interested in tends to be older, so it's not really like it's always available to download. Sometimes I just have to buy a record, and I still love buying records, but I still have that attachment to it. But the thing is, like, we're moving to an era where the technology, we haven't caught up to the technology. Like, we haven't caught up to a way to make our needs and the technology balanced. Like, our needs are so out of whack with what the technology is. Like, I'm the same way. Like, you download a song, you don't even get through it, you delete it, you download another song, you get halfway through it, delete it. You know, it's just like, we just consume so much information, and there's no environmental costs, which is maybe why we're moving to this, because our world is strapped for resources now, so maybe that's why we're moving to a quote-unquote pure information-based society. But the fact that we are moving towards this stuff, I think we're at that weird flux period between two eras where we don't really know how to navigate this next era yet. And we're going to learn, you know, and hopefully it's not going to be the Jay-Z model. Hopefully it's not going to be.
We are getting closer. I mean, when you look now, like I can literally like set up my one click on Amazon. Yeah. And it's like if I want to get something, it's literally a push of a button. Like it's never been easier to get something. It's just trying to get that into people's mentality that, you know, you should probably
buy
this.
But also I don't want to say like I think artists have – and I think we were talking this a little before we went on air, and we won't mention the names. But I think artists, and I include wrestlers as – are the art wrestlers in this thing too, to paraphrase from Colt Cabana. But like I think we've forgotten the role that we have, which is like if someone's paying for your content, they're your employer in a weird way. So you kind of owe them a little something, and that means you owe them maybe some responsibility depending on what your band is and depending on what they bought into you for. So if you're like a quote-unquote political band and you're still getting money from other places, you know, you kind of let down the people that bought your record. You know, if you're Jay-Z, people have gone into this knowing that you play by a different set of rules when it
and
comes
it's never
money.
Been easier to connect the dots.
And I think
like
you see this with some wrestlers now too, where just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. Just because you can shill for everything doesn't mean you should shill for everything, because these people, if you build up an honest relationship with the people, that's why I don't feel bad about people downloading my record, because I know there's people that come to our shows that will buy the record, you know, and I know I'll talk to them after the show, and if they want to come to me and talk to me as a person, they can anytime. I think that's the thing about social media. When it works well, it allows you to become the person to the person that only sees you as the producer of some sort of product, you know, be it music, wrestling, whatever. And I think the thing is now is we're seeing a lot of these musicians not use that for that, but use it instead as just a way to shill and to kind of like market to people. And then people are like,
I honestly feel that stuff is really going to die out, because I think it's, you know, yeah, whether it's wrestling and kind of what we're more attached to, and you can obviously speak to it more in music as well. It's just, to me, that style of just shill, it's just people are sick of that, and they're going to get away from that because, you know, you coming on here and doing a 20-minute interview, just constantly pumping up your next show or your next album or whatever, it's like that's going to be in one ear, out the other. Whereas this here, you coming on here every couple of months and talking, I think that does
Like outside of this, because I love doing this more for me.
But that's what I mean. That comes across is like you feel like you want to be here. This isn't a chore where you just want to get some money out of some people listening to
this. I think that's the – but it could go that way where people could forget about this and be like, that's gross. Let's support these artists. You know, and I think you see that with crowdfunding a lot of ways, you know, like crowdfunding, people are like, oh, it sucks. Blah, blah, blah. Well, you're paying for someone to do something they're going to be doing anyway. If you support them, maybe fund them doing it. I'm not saying this is like you know, people get ripped off at it, which sucks, you know, but like if you like an artist and you're like, I really like this musician, I believe in this musician, I want to support them.
Yeah.
You can crowdfund
Most often you get something tangible.
Yeah, you get something tangible out of it, but also you're like actually supporting that artist. You can go that way, and you know, where you go to shows, or it can go the other way where it's just all jingles and it's all corporate money. Like every show you play is a free show, but every show's underwritten by a corporation, and then that does affect content. And I know a lot of people will be like, "Oh, it doesn't affect content." My content has been affected in situations where we had a corporate sponsor pull out of funding something based on an article Mike wrote critical of the sponsorship at South by Southwest. We had a company pull out of sponsoring a festival we were playing. And so a bunch of bands were not going to be paid.
Wow.
And something in the end. But there was
a big deal about, I think it was South by Southwest, where a lot of comedians are like pulling out of it now because it's assumed that you'll come and
work for free.
And it's like, I'm coming here, and it's and there seems to be this revolt against this.
It's a weird thing, because South by Southwest is like the best. It's the craziest thing in the world. It's an amazing experience. And I think South by Southwest is a unique thing unto itself, because you go down there, it's like you sign up for that experience, that world. That being said, there's a lot of people making money on it, and maybe that money,
I think,
not
that's the issue here. It's
being
like
distributed
kind
properly.
Of the idea of this whole event has kind of morphed into something else where we're still expecting you to work for free, but this thing is a cash cow now.
It's still like there is nothing else like it, and it's still like, you know, I would never go to Disney World and complain about the corporatization of Disney World.
Yeah.
So I can't really complain about South by Southwest being a corporate feeding ground, because that's what the music industry is right now, unfortunately. Like, believe me, if all these musicians were like, screw these corporations, we don't want them here. And I know there's some that are doing it, but if all of them did that, they wouldn't be there. You know, like they are only, it's only reflective of the true kind of thoughts and motivations of bands, which is, you know, greed at sometimes, you know, ultimately it's ego and greed, unfortunately, in a lot of cases. And as it was in WCW.
When Ric Flair retained his presidency.
Oh, my God.
It was influenced by greed.
That's like, this should be a severed podcast, The Digression.
I love these shows. They're my favorites. So anyway, we go back to DJ Ran, who yells to the crowd.
Like I need to know, everybody in here, tell me what you think about Roddy Piper. What I thought, but don't forget, we still got a hot main event coming up. Anybody here like big sexy Kevin Nash? I'm gonna ask you a question. If you think he's gonna kick Macho Man's ass tonight, say hell yeah. Say hell yeah. Say hell yeah. Now scream to my man Tony Schiavone. What?
You got it, big guy. How come he can cuss and we can't?
Back to you, Schiavone.
So great. So great. Promising us a hot main event, which we would hold DJ Ran to. From there, there was a video for the next match, which may be my favorite match in history.
This is the greatest thing I've ever seen on any wrestling pay-per-view.
First of all, television champion Rick Steiner about to engage in a non-title grudge match. No DQ. Anything goes, falls count anywhere with Rick Steiner and Sting.
Also, I was going to say, this is the Steiner. This is the point in Rick Steiner's career where you realize he's the shitty brother. When they were the Steiner brothers, I was like, oh, wow. Like, he's like the cool, bearded, tough one, you know? And now you see them, they kind of have the same look. You're like, oh, you're just the shittier version of the better looking guy.
This was a heel Rick Steiner.
Yeah, the heel Rick Steiner, but who just gets, like, as baby faces, they were both great as a babyface tag team, but as heels, you get to see that one is a little superior to the other.
Yes, this was
felt like my brother and I.
I guess after you feud with Chucky, the doll, the only way to go is to turn heel after
that's
that.
That's true. This is the most Hollywood company of all time. RoboCop, Chucky.
Oh, they love this shit.
The movie.
They loved it. Steiner attacks Sting right from the start, and they go to the floor. Sting has the advantage, dropping him on the barricade. I mean, very little chemistry between these two throughout this match. Just very flat to me. Sting misses a splash going into the barricade. There was a pile driver by Rick Steiner onto the floor. A released German by Steiner working his all Japan hard strong style. Sting hit a few Vader bombs. Steiner with a low blow. Then they fight up the ramp. Oh, first of all, Sting applied the Scorpion Deathlock as Rick Steiner reaches the ropes and the ref starts counting to five in this anything goes match.
Yeah.
What would have happened if he reached five?
I was wondering that too.
Would this have been a DQ in an anything goes match?
But I think that's one of those things that referees just go into autopilot in those situations. Like earlier, there's also a Ric Flair eye poke, and the referee just seems to like automatically go into admonishing. Not Ric Flair, sorry, Piper eye poke, and the referee just automatically goes into like admonishing him mode.
They fight up the ramp, and Sting hits a vertical suplex right by the WCW.com booth, which was featuring Mark Madden, Chris Jericho, and Chad the Deli Boy Demiani. This was Chris Jericho's work for the night. Six-figure contract.
Thing.
He's about to leave the company. He's going to do WCW.com.
And then it goes into the worst inserted pre-tape I've ever seen. Like, it's crazy.
You mispronounced best.
The worst best pre-tape. Well, best worst pre-tape I've ever seen.
They go to the back, where the recently signed Tank Abbott, another six-figure contract, starts choking Sting. Scott Steiner
is... No, but you have to say with this cloth, because I had to go back and watch this, because the cloth is used in the next segment. So I'm like, okay, well, they have to give him something to protect himself from what's coming next. So he takes the cloth and falls down with Tank Abbott. But then it cuts. The camera cuts at this point. So this is not, you know, you could have explained it some other way. Anyway, go on.
I cannot convey my just sheer amazement as I watched three Rottweilers unleashed onto Sting, who was actually the legitimate dog's trainer dressed as Sting. It was not Steve Borden who did this stunt.
It looks like Steve Borden in the face. Is that why there's – because there's so many cuts. Like if they –
there were so many cuts here that they might have used Sting for at least the beginning of it. But
yeah.
The bites and stuff I think was all done by the dog's trainer.
Because now you see the Tank Abbott strangulation rag is being used for the dog to bite on Sting's arm. Too. I'm like, where did this rag from?
Then they cut to like the dynamic duo of fucking security teams with Doug Dillinger running in front of like a mob of security who are just sprinting to the scene of the crime.
You can't forget that also that there's also Scott Steiner walking with that one dog. But he's like so afraid of this dog, like slowly walking, trying to release the leash and lets the dog go running. And then it cuts to a separate shot of I guess, the dog trainer being bit.
The Baja Men, the answer to the question was Scott Steiner and Tank Abbott.
Oh, my gosh.
So the match is just waved off here. And then we go back to the crowd.
It's not waved off. Apparently, the match is when it goes to that crowd shot, this is where the pinfall, I guess, happens. When I watch it again, because they start – sorry, go on. And then
I'm just going to say, how much weight does an Anything Goes match have? I mean, dogs trump the stipulation
here? The Steiners were made the winners
because
it was Falls Count Anywhere, because then Rick Steiner and Scott Steiner
came back to the ring after the crowd's chanting bullshit at this.
Yeah.
They were already upset when they went to the back.
And they have to explain what happened. They're like, what you didn't see, because WCW is too scared to show the graphic nature of it, was that my brother got on top of Sting and pinned him. Is that right? And the referee's like, yeah, that's right. So he is the winner, right? Yeah, that's right. He's the winner. Okay, so we now have explained what happened that you didn't see be backstage happening.
Scott Steiner doing a tremendous recap here of what happened that we missed.
Oh, sorry.
Informed the crowd that he's glad that Rick is with him in the NWO because WCW sucks. And then Rick asks, what is the shittiest town in America? And he yells, Baltimore.
And he sounds like a shittier version of his brother, too, at this point. Like, everything about him is like he's got the worst ring gear with the two stupid Mack truck dogs on his shoulders. Like, is it, everything about it is just like, I would just leave the company and be like, my brother is just stealing all the spotlight. It's like the Dudley Boys now.
If you don't like me, bite me.
Yeah, exactly.
This was just something else, everyone. An all-time classic WCW moment here with
the dogs.
The Rottweilers. Then we went to a video, DDP and Bam Bam Bigelow teaming up. I have no fucking idea how this match was put together. There were so many swerves and turns and title changes, but it ends up with Chris Benoit and Perry Saturn as WCW Tag Team Champions defending against Diamond Dallas Page and Chris Kanyon for these tag titles.
Yeah.
The highlight being Chris Benoit and Perry Saturn coming out and the name key for them reading Brian Knobs. Yes. The best.
It shows where they were at the company at this point.
I remember this is the only match I can possibly paint as good on this
show. I'm gonna say everyone in this I'm a fan of, even DDP. I love DDP.
Oh, yeah.
He's such a great baby face.
I remember
he's good as a heel in this too.
They did this match this month and the following month at Bash at the Beach, and I remember at the time just loving these matches with these four.
The opening Kanyon versus Benoit thing is awesome, like kind of chain wrestling thing. Like everyone in this is a good worker. What's his name who's on this side?
Bigelow,
Bam Bam Bigelow.
Yeah, he was hurt actually. During this time, so that's why he was on the, and they did the Freebirds gimmick with Page, Kanyon, and Bigelow. So I guess for ECW here we have Benoit, Saturn, and Bigelow adding to the
three
list
more.
Here of
We're
ECW
at seven so far.
And also here, quite the deceased count on this show as well. When you look at
a lot of bodies:
Savage, Kanyon, Benoit. I'm sure there are more that I'm not thinking of.
There's definitely someone on the undercard.
We move
career wise Bagwell.
Well, yeah, he was kind of gone after that WWE week.
Yeah,
a week run in both senses of the word, whether you want to spell it one way or the other.
Yeah.
1 week run. Bigelow lifts Benoit and drops him on the barricade as they got the advantage. They got the heat on Benoit, kind of similar to the Mysterio Conan match where they just got heat on Benoit forever and then teasing the hot tag to Saturn and even doing the fake tag. The match here was almost like a backdrop, though, to Schiavone giving us updates on Sting and just outraged. And he gives, like, this commentary on wrestling that I'm a fan of the hardcore style. I like the chair shots. I like kendo sticks, but not dogs. That's over the line.
But you know what? This really puts in perspective. Like, why are we saying that Teddy Hart's such a genius? He's not. He stole all his good ideas from WCW. He just put cats in place of dogs.
But what if this Rottweiler did a moonsault?
Oh, my God. Well, the one was standing up the entire time while biting Sting, so I think it's ready to do a standing suplex.
Paige powerbombs Benoit, then Canyon misses a moonsault and is overselling it. Benoit makes the hot tag to Saturn, who is attacking both. They hit a top rope splash to Paige for a two count. They went into a bunch of near falls. They went into this close-up of Canyon where you can hear him calling his next spot with Benoit. Benoit hits his consecutive Germans with Paige breaking the final bridging German to Canyon. And then Benoit with a dragon suplex, which is broken up by Paige. Benoit and Saturn then go to the top rope with Benoit hitting a headbutt to Canyon. But then Paige comes and hits a diamond cutter to Saturn off the top rope. And Saturn's selling on the floor when Dean Malenko comes down to help Saturn. And the referee was so distracted with Saturn, who's the illegal man of his well-being, that he turned his back for like a solid minute here as Bigelow and DDP gave him like a Benoit super diamond cutter, and it allowed Paige to place Canyon on top of Benoit for the win. They went 19 minutes and 13 seconds, and the winners and new tag champions are the Jersey Triad of Paige, Canyon, and Bigelow, and then they beat up Malenko after the match as well and pose with the titles.
I know. Then what a cool faction they would have been.
Yeah, they got such a short run out of this with these three, and I really enjoyed these three together, and they had some great chemistry here with Benoit and Saturn. They do it again the following month. The only good match, I would say, on this show,
on the card,
like
yeah.
that you could call good, you know, in the three or more star quality.
Yeah, but, like it had, and everyone in it kind of knew their roles, and it also, until the very end, there weren't that many, you know, screwy things going on. No dogs. Put it that way.
No
after dog, the dogs.
Clean, this was about as clean a finish as you're going to get on this fucking pay-per-view.
Exactly.
Then we got the video for the main event with more great shit that wasn't in the opening video, including an angle where Savage put lipstick all over Kevin Nash's face. This angle was so great that the visual of Savage putting this on, they used it in two separate sequences in this video. Just like, look what we did. There was some dude who came out dressed in drag as Kevin Nash who got beat up by Savage. And then Savage proclaiming that they're going to put Nash back in the closet where he needs to stay. I mean, just offending anyone out there.
But at this point, like, you know, is it really – there are so many boundaries that are going to be crossed by wrestling in the next few years that
– Yeah, What can we not offend here?
99 is just an appetizer for 2000.
Again, the raw sewage attacks, this contortionist, which at least is something I've never seen before.
Yeah, it looked awesome.
For those that didn't see it, Nash comes out with a gym bag and says, "I've got my gear here, Savage. Let's fight." Savage comes out as Nash bails and
he's got the thing of sewage.
Yeah, and he puts it down, and then the bag opens, and this contortionist comes out of a gym bag and pours the sewage onto Savage. Inventive.
Incredible.
I will say inventive. Incredible. If someone pitched this to me, I would have okayed it for my show.
I don't know why they don't use more contortionists in wrestling.
I'm surprised. I don't think we've ever seen a contortionist.
No, and I'm like, if you want to get a move over, like talk about like if you have someone that has to pop someone's shoulder out, like I'm sure they can make it look like they popped something or broke something.
So if you weren't excited, and then we had the white Hummer angle, and the best here was with Nash's last ounce of power after being murdered by a Hummer, he punches the window of the limo. Our babyface is still alive, and we go off the air wondering if we'll have a main event on Sunday.
I was wondering if it was gimmicked.
Yeah.
If that window was gimmicked.
I think Nash was smart enough to gimmick windows. Michael Buffer does the introduction, saying that we are about to witness history with the best big man in sports and the most dangerous man in the sport.
I thought the intros were, like, you know, it makes it feel... It's always like this with WCW. It makes it feel like you're watching a legitimate contest between two athletes, especially where they're like putting over Savage and everything he's done. And then you watch this and you're like, this guy must be like, it's just a paycheck.
This was during the time when Randy Savage was trying to update himself to the late 90s in wrestling. So we had him
this is looking at it TNA too when he came back. Kind
yeah,
of
he had
bag.
Like the tied back hair, the crazy tan, and his what up match. Rock anthem.
Well, this is just before he went into his rap career, too.
That's true.
You know, he's probably writing rhymes backstage, discovering hip-hop this entire time.
Yes, and he also had his savagely sexy entourage consisting of his girlfriend, Gorgeous George, which was weird because the Poffo family had bought the intellectual rights to the name Gorgeous George. They were going to give it to Lanny Poffo, who never took it. So he said, ah, fuck it. I'll give it to my girlfriend, Stephanie Ballars.
Really?
Who I think was a stripper before this. And accompanied as well by Medusa and Miss Madness, who would go on to become Molly Holly.
Oh, that's Molly. Okay, that's yes. Why she looks so familiar.
Yeah.
And that explains why she's so good at doing the dropkick.
Yes. The best workers were on the floor during this match.
Yeah, exactly.
Nash comes out limping, and Buffer is meanwhile, like, going through all these fucking, like, known for his ignore the pain attitude, and walks into this with rib and knee injuries, but has ignored the doctor's orders. Like, just so ridiculous when you consider this is the guy who's booking this at the time, the WCW champion, the man who's known for his
He wouldn't have written his own intro, would he?
I hope not. But if he did, this is what I imagine he would. I'm an ignore the pain attitude kind of guy.
The greatest champion in the WWF ever.
Wow. Then we got this horrendous match. 7.5 minutes of nothing here.
Nothing.
Mike Tenay reinforced the fact that the top rope elbow has been reinstated. Nash, the banged up Kevin Nash, immediately gets the advantage right away, using his injured knee to attack Savage in the corner. How many suck it references did we count here with Kevin Nash?
Oh, so many.
Just this guy trying to be so cool at this time. Nash was selling his ribs as he continued to attack
Savage.
He also
looked kind of puffy. Did you notice that too?
Yeah, a little bit. Tenay notes that this is going to limit Nash's usual offense.
He's still got to do the jackhammer and the high kick, you know? He's still doing all right.
Let's listen to this clip here of Tony Schiavone as he tries to recap the storyline between these two.
What a buildup of bad blood between these two men leading into this world title bout here on this, the 13th day of June. Sewage was involved, a lady in a duffel bag, the use of the lipstick, the horrible crash in the limousine.
Just completely utter nonsense here of what has led us to this match. Medusa kicked Nash in the ribs on the floor. Savage continues to attack him. I mean, these two were just so just brittle at this point in time. Like, Savage just had nothing here.
Well, yeah, because this is what does he do after this little run?
This was about it. This was really it. This summer, he would kind of disappear. He made a cameo in early 2000, but he was pretty much done after this summer. He would work the July and August pay-per-views, and then he was pretty much gone.
And then it's that first year of TNA. He does that two shows.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, I mean, he was pretty much done.
He looks huge.
He's jacked here. He's definitely on the list.
He was going to be my Scott Putski nominee.
Yeah, he probably wins it.
And it's hard because it's not defined, but just like on mass.
But this is a guy who probably his frame was built for like 60 pounds less than what he was. Nash hits a big boot. The straps come down. This is after Miss Madness hits a top rope drop kick to Kevin Nash. Easily the most athletic spot. One of the most athletic spots on the show, I would say.
Yeah, probably.
Anyway, then.
The shoulder block.
Of course. Well, that's number one,
of course. Swole. The high spot of the show.
Medusa comes in, kicking the ribs of Nash. Then Gorgeous George jumps on the back, and Nash flips her over, where I believe she falls out of her top. Medusa then is caught. Miss Madness takes the snake eyes onto the top turnbuckle as the crowd chants this man beating up the women. Then, out of nowhere, Sid Vicious runs in, delivering a big boot to Kevin Nash. We get a DQ finish at 7:28. As Nash keeps the title.
That bump to Miss Madness where you get the jackhammer into the corner. It's so awesome. It's like this, like the level of insanity in this thing. It's like, and I like how Sid Vicious waits till after he does that before he does the run in.
This was Sid's return to WCW after he was fired following his scissors fight with Arn Anderson in a hotel in England. Returning to the company, he was going to spark the return of WCW to prominence.
That's what Dallas Green wrote Save Your Scissors about.
Is it?
No, I'm just kidding.
No, you're fucking with me now.
It'd be amazing, though. That song would be like,
I never know with you.
That'd be amazing, that song, though.
So Sid powerbombs Nash. He lands very awkwardly as Mike Tenay calls Sid Vicious psychotic. And Schiavone speculates if Sid was the Hummer driver, but says, you can throw logic right out the window, though.
Didn't he say, like, that is the Hummer driver? Wasn't that the
reveal? I don't know why they just didn't close the book and say Sid was the driver.
Yeah.
That would have made total sense, and they would have closed the book on this. But they kept it going forever, and it never had a conclusion.
Oh,
this could have been it for all of history's sake.
They just skipped their out.
And it ends up, Savage looks really messed up here after the match as he's being helped to the back with Sid, who's now joined the Savagely Sexy Entourage as Sexy Sid, I guess.
The sexiest member.
And boy, the idea of a Kevin Nash-Sid feud was just beaming in people's minds.
To be honest with you, though, as an uneducated wrestling fan, as a kid in the, like, more prior to this, though, that would have been my dream match. Psycho Sid versus Diesel. Oh,
well, we got in WWF once. Well,
oh, yeah, that's
not?
Right. There was. That's probably why I loved it so much.
Well, that was on the horizon for the summer of WCW here in 1999, the final summer of the millennium. And they go off the air with a horrendous Bash at the Beach ad where it's like everyone's enjoying the sun of they're out on the beach. They're having a great time. And then it gets all overcast. And a Bash at the Beach logo comes out like Satan from the skies. It's
they
like,
knew.
As it starts lightning, I'm like, boy, what a metaphor for this
they
event.
Knew.
And then the final graphic you see is a warning that no animals were harmed during the broadcast of this event. You couldn't go off the air with a better moment than this. Awesome.
That's because they had to edit the scorpion death driver that he gave him the scorpion driver to. The dog,
he had to
get
the dog.
To get rid of the dogs. I like, you know what, this show really showed me why WWE does the thing where everyone's like, oh, how come there's only one John Cena? How come there's only one main event? Because there's like so many things that are being built to and like almost feel like the main event in this show, or like not actually like the main event, but like being marketed as the main event, that it'd be like going to a concert and having every band have a huge light show, have the good sound. When you go to those big stadium shows, they make it clear who the headliner is. Like when we were opening for the Foo Fighters, we were allowed a lot of stuff, but I was not allowed on their ramp.
Wow.
You know, and like, you know, they had a better light show than us, but it's almost like if you have everything kind of detracting from the main event, like this never really felt like it's a main event in name only.
Really was a shitty, shitty main event. In all honesty, one of the worst WCW pay-per-views I've watched, but at the same
Amazing,
time,
yeah.
Not I
boring.
Was entertained
Not
by the horrible nature of some of the shit on this show that I've watched way worse. The worst shows are ones that are long and boring.
Mm-hmm.
This was not boring, and I give this a 3 out of 10, Damien.
I would give this, like, for entertainment value, yeah, I'd say a 3 out of 10, too. Like,
I think that's a fair comment on – at least if you were in on the joke, WCW was wildly entertaining.
And if you knew where this was going. You know, like
they were going into that median.
Like normally it's not fun when you know the ending, but in this case, when you know the ending, it's fun to look back and be like, well, that could have,
yeah, this is when when the wheels fell off.
Yeah, like, this is when the wheels are starting to fall off, and you really get to see, like, in some of these guys and some of the angles, especially, like, that the wheels are falling off.
So, a very fun show to review. Damien, I thank you very much
for
sitting through this one.
Oh, please. Any time. I had an amazing time. I love coming here.
This is we might be setting some records here on this show.
I think we're setting a record. In no way here, even.
No way. I know he was very despondent, the fact that he was going to miss the Master P edition of the Great American Bash. But I told him that 2 weeks after this pay-per-view, they booked the New Orleans Superdome. In Master P's hometown, which is where WrestleMania is going to be, just to have this
year,
in
yeah.
scope. And Master P was bragging to WCW that, man, just advertising me on this show, it's going to sell out. It did not sell out, and I will try and track down this because I know Wei wants to
That's
weigh
amazing.
In on some Master P.
That's
so
awesome.
That'll be a future review. But I'm going to set up next week's review, but then Damien is going to long-term book for us because
yeah.
you're going to come back in about a month
yeah.
To chat a particular documentary. But next week, Wei Ting will be returning, everybody, and we are going to review the WWF King of the Ring event from June of 2000 in Boston. I feel the best way to get Wei back into things is by watching Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe in drag have a match in Boston. So that is what we are going to review next week to cap off June and King of the Ring month, so to speak. So that's coming up next week. And in about a month or so, Damien,
yes.
you have recently you have a story attached to
yeah.
this, too, about what you want to review with us.
I was recently on tour in England. And we're going to London to play a show, and we stopped at a gas station, or services as I like to call them in the UK. And we get out of the van, and I go in there, and I'm buying like a bottle of water or something. And I see this guy, and he looks really familiar, but I can't place him. Because I'm not really seeing him in anywhere I'd expect to see him, right? And so he goes, I guess, to the bathroom, kind of comes out. And then there's my mic, our guitar player, is like, who's that dude? And I'm like, I don't know, he looked really familiar to me. And he's like, yeah, he kind of looks like a wrestler, I think. I'm like, oh, and then I see another guy wearing a pro wrestling sweater. And I'm like thinking in my head, I'm like, yeah, he kind of does look like a wrestler. I'm like, look at this guy's sweater. Look back at this dude who's now going towards the car. And I'm like, oh my God, I run after him. I'm like, are you Nigel McGuinness? He's like, yeah, I'm Nigel. And I'm like, what's up? Oh my God, where to see? I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, I'm touring my documentary. And I'm like, oh, I really want to see it. He's like, I have one for sale. Always a worker.
Oh man.
So,
gotta love it.
I bought one off him and he signed it for me. I got a photo with him and everything, but I have actually yet to watch it because I was hoping that I could come in and review it with
you
guys.
Yes, yes. Let's do it in a couple of weeks because I have it. I've watched it. I might go back and watch some of the scenes over again. But we will definitely review that.
Yeah, I'd love to do it because he seemed like a really cool guy.
It's an interesting documentary. I won't say anything more. We'll save it for the review. But myself and Wei, we will watch it and then have you back in a couple of weeks.
Excellent.
And we will chat the last of McGuinness, which has got a lot of praise from people that have seen it. And this gives people a couple of weeks to try and go seek it out and watch it. Pay for the documentary.
Yeah, like here's something where it's like all those arguments of, oh, he's a millionaire. It's like
he's not.
He's riding four to a car, people, and it was a small car. Like, trust me, like this is something where you can, and there's ways. I think High Spots has it on demand.
Yeah, it does, and that's another
it's
thing.
Like
it's
$5.
Like the idea of like, you know, you got to pay for something and wait for it to be shipped. That's eliminated.
No, yeah,
pretty much.
High Spots I think has it for on demand. Probably iTunes even probably has it by now.
Yeah, I would think so. So check that out. The Last of McGuinness. We will do that in a couple of weeks in July on this show, and next week we will be back. King of the Ring 2000 as Wei Ting returns. Do follow Damien at Left for Damien on Twitter. And what's coming up for you? What's coming up in the near future? I'm going to be the shill and plug your Now magazine thing and find an address for it.
Just writing a new record. We're starting to write this brand new record. It's going to be about like kind of what we digress to talking about here. Hopefully it's going to be about being a musician and kind of feeling conflicted about where you sit in the world in this present day and realizing that
a heavy one.
You've gotten everything you wanted. Like, I really am living my dream, but you've had to compromise some things in the way. And in that compromising, have you hurt what you came out of or hurt kind of the greater world around you? Are you part of the problem and stuff? So, yeah,
very
like
cool.
I don't want it to be too – it sounds like so fucking pretentious now.
No.
But I want it to be kind of reflection, you know, like I didn't even think we were going to make another record after the last record. So this time it's like, you know, I got to see a lot of stuff last year that I never thought I'd be a part of. And a lot of stuff I never wanted to be a part of, but I kind of found myself a part of it as a willing participant and realizing that it's like the idea of like trying to reconcile and be at peace with yourself as an idealistic 23-year-old at 33.
Yeah, this is very cool.
Hopefully it's not a record.
I'm not just saying that. I think the idea, you come across as someone that certainly has a conscience rather than just throwing out whatever, you know what I mean?
Well, I just think it's like one of those weird things where you're in a position of incredible fortuitousness, I guess, when you don't have to have a job which requires like work, you know, it allows you to be creative all the time, you know?
Sure.
And I think there is like an obligation. That's why I'm saying everyone should go out and become super overtly political and platform and rally around causes, because ultimately musicians are just as terrible as anyone else and will let you down and let the cause down. But at the same time, you do owe people honesty, hopefully. And so this is my attempt to kind of like – this is my atoning for my sins of vanity.
Atoning for the sins of vanity. That's like the name of the album.
That's a lyric actually on one of the songs.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm stealing from myself now. But, now that's a Law exclusive. When you hear it, you guys will be like, that's so cheesy. He uses that line all the time.
Okay. Well, if any of you have ever stolen Damien's music, you can atone for your sins by going to nowtoronto.com/bestof. Every year, Now Magazine, which is like this free, magazine in Toronto. Every year they do their Best of Toronto list. So you go to nowtoronto.com/bestof and they've got all the different categories. You can go to music and then you go to best band. And I want to get your thoughts, Damien, on your competition here.
All right.
I have already voted and I'm very biased. That's why I voted for you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So we'll see. I'm not familiar with, I think, any of these.
Okay,
so
let's go through.
Let's do like word association.
I was going to say, I would never tell anyone to watch The Wedge, but you should... If you get a chance to check out The Wedge, they're going to post it online this week. I do all wrestling promos about all the indie artists.
When can people watch it?
It's going to be online soon. It aired last night, and I'm sure it'll be up sometime this week. But
okay,
it's like
cool.
It's me for the Wedge Wrestling Federation, WWF.
Cutting
promos like wrestling style on all the indie artists. But
I'll totally.
So it's not like so it's me trying to like do all this stuff. So
awesome.
It's my tribute to old Memphis tapes.
Okay, something. Well, give us like a quick quick thought on each of these bands, okay?
These are probably my friends, so I can't even get promos on them.
Okay. Ostra.
Ostra's amazing. That's our friend Katie Swimanis, who actually sings on a couple of our songs. Mike put out her first record from our band, so she's like she's our home girl. Like we've known her forever, Katie, and she's
so. If you lost
awesome.
To them, you'd be.
Yeah, I'd accept it. You know, I can't. It's like if I there's some artists, and hopefully they're not on this list, that if I lose to, I'd be like, well, fuck them. But if I lose to like Ostra or I'm sure any number of these artists, like I can definitely find peace with it. You know.
It's weird. They've got like all these like artists with like their website and Twitter under the Beauties. It's like 249 Ossington Avenue. Is that like where they live?
Yeah, they have a space.
Oh,
okay. These are a cool band. Definitely like of Toronto, you know?
Do you know these candidates ahead of time or am I breaking this?
I don't know these candidates ahead of time. I've not seen this list.
Okay.
So, but this is, but yeah, I do know these bands.
Okay. Well, you can go visit the Beauties live in person.
Yeah, go to their house.
How about Mets?
Mets are fantastic. We just went on tour with them. We share a practice space with them. I've known years ago when I applied for a job at HMV as an unemployable young man, Chris Slorak from Mets tried to get me a job at HMV.
Oh, really?
Really went to bat for me. And
this is
so,
like, it's such a small world.
Yeah, it's really Toronto.
I guess we're talking about city awards.
Yeah,
so
but
I guess
also
it would
Toronto,
be, right?
Toronto, I find like you can find anyone through like 2 or 3 degrees. You know, like it's crazy how
sure.
close you get to people. Like I was watching a TV special about Drake and they had his producer come on and I'm like, wow, that kid looks so familiar, and they didn't put the key up immediately. I'm like, oh, I went to high school with that kid. And then it's like 40 and it's like, that's Drake's producer, 40.
Wow.
And it's like, I went to high school with that kid.
You know what's crazy, there's a Rogers ad now for like your so that you can program your PVR
on your
iPad.
Yeah,
and the guy he's talking and in the back there's like this old wrestling footage, and then he goes onto his iPad, and it's like Ultimate Classic Wrestling,
really?
Which is the show I host on Fight
yeah,
Network.
Yeah,
it's just so random that that would be the programming that they would choose to sell this Rogers.
I know, especially because Rogers
contraption.
Owns their own content.
Like, yeah, it's very weird.
On it. But that's good. That's awesome. Like, plug.
Zeus.
Zeus are a fantastic band, like affiliated with Arts and Crafts. Jason Collette, they used to play with Jason Collette. And, you know, like, once again, like another band, like. You know, once again, like a real Toronto band, you know, like, I don't know if they're all born and raised in downtown Toronto, like fucked up, mind you. Just saying.
Yeah, just getting it in there. They're not going to be listening to this. How about the Lemon Bucket Orchestra?
I do not know them.
Okay.
That's crazy. Like, that shows you how out of touch I've become now that I'm a father of two, that I'm now, that's crazy. I don't know a band from Toronto. I feel ashamed. I'm now going to have to check out the Lemon Bucket Orchestra, but don't vote for them.
Yeah. You can't just vote blind.
Yeah, vote blind.
Crystal Castles.
Obviously, huge band, electronic. Do you know them?
I don't know them.
Really?
No.
Seems like something you might be into.
I might.
Like, it's like aggressive electronic type stuff, female vocals, you know, it's members of ex-members of Cheerleader 666, and I can't remember what the lead singer's band, Alice's old band, was called. But yeah, like another band that, like, you know, really kind of put Toronto on the map in a big way, music-wise, internationally, as like a cool city.
Cool. I will check them out. The Weeknd.
Oh, of course. Weeknd is what's his real name? But it's like R&B guy who. Him and Frank Ocean and maybe Miguel are like changing the face of R&B. Some people call it PBR R&B.
Ah.
Because it's kind of hipster R&B. But Weeknd's like definitely a guy who's like, you know, any Canadian artist that makes that much of an impact based on a mixtape. Granted, he did get a co-sign from Drake, but.
That helps.
You know, but he's doing all right. He's no longer with Drake at all.
Wow.
And stuff. So he's kind of doing his own thing. He's on CP Records. But yeah, once again, another artist that. Probably has sold way more than us, so definitely deserving to be on it. And he gave away his stuff for free, and he still managed to sell more than us.
And we got two more here. Blue Rodeo.
Oh, how can I go against Blue Rodeo? That's Canada's own, you know?
There you go.
Like, I they're
only
first...
10,000 followers on Twitter, though.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's because, let's be honest, their fan base is not the type that use Twitter.
Probably not.
No, but also, they started as a punk band. Greg and
I knew that actually.
Yeah, like
yes.
they Hi-Fi's power pop punk band, and then the first Blue Rodeo single, which actually has Try, which to me is still one of the best Canadian songs ever, came out in like 1985, and they put it out themselves. But Yeah, I used to actually Jim Cuddy from Blue Rodeo. My friend used to babysit for his kids, and like, yeah, I got nothing for love for them. So if I lose to them too, it's like, man, that's like, you know, losing the. It'd be like being Jay Rheotard and losing King of Memphis to Elvis. You know, like you have to capitulate.
And the last one, Bruce Peninsula.
Drake's not on that list.
I guess he's not considered. Well, these are bands, right? Like,
oh, okay.
It's best,
yeah, that's
Toronto
true.
Bands.
Bruce Peninsula, like a classic sort of Toronto indie band.
But I wonder if they consider Drake still Toronto.
I bet.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. He's probably under best rapper. Yeah, he's under best rapper. With Drake, Chaos, Kanon, Rich Kid, and Slock of the Beat Child.
I love
Rich
Kid.
And Decisive.
I like Rich Kid a lot. And, oh, Decisive. That's my homie, Decisive.
Oh, fuck. How do you get Decisive out of that?
I love Decisive.
It actually totally. Decisive.
I love Decisive. I give him props. And I definitely think he's one of the best
the
rappers.
White guy, Pollock.
Drake's one of those dudes that, you know, it changed. Like, talk about a paradigm shift. Talk about, like, people talked about Canadian hip hop and a Canadian hip hop artist making it in America. And it used to be like they got mentioned in The Source or got some, like, international award on the BET Awards. Like, now, then it was like Drake came out. And now it's like, oh, yeah, they're the biggest rapper in the world now. That's how you can tell a Canadian rapper's successful. And it's like, yeah, he's like someone that, you know, a lot of people like to hate on Drake, and you can say, well, start from the bottom, that's Forest Hill, and like, believe me, you would not be the first, I've said it too, but like, here's a guy that, you know, changed the face of Toronto music in a way that no, people have been trying for years,
oh,
you
sure.
know, and like, and really had an impact in a way that, you know, none of us, like, no one could ever imagine having that sort of cultural impact, so like, you know, Drake's someone that I think will forever be a Toronto artist.
So if you weren't to win this, who do you think would be the odds-on favorite? Who's the band to
favorite.
Beat?
Favorite. It's hard to pick favorites. Crystal Castles, but Blue Rodeo. Broken Social Scene's not on that either.
No.
I guess maybe they're not active, but
I got to hear their whole set a couple of weekends ago.
Oh, yeah.
When they did the Fort York
thing. Yeah.
I can hear it like right from my condo.
Oh, that's right. You're crazy. Do you like them?
I did like them for quite a time, yeah.
Yeah, they're another group that, like, you know, I definitely do not think that we, you know, rode their coattails in any great way, but I think like they were another band that changed the landscape for Canadian independent artists.
I think
too.
So. Absolutely.
You know,
like
in as far
2003,
as
2004, yeah. I mean, completely influential.
Toronto internationally always had like a Toronto the Good, boring reputation, and like them, Death from Above 1979, you know, and
fucked up.
Not, we came later, but they were like the cooling of Toronto. You know, we got to ride the great Vice hardcore interest, when Vice magazine got interested in hardcore and then subsequently led into the great Pitchfork interest in hardcore, which we also got to ride a little bit too.
Is this, I should send this to Pitchfork. Damien Abraham breaks down the best of Toronto candidates. Or,
you could.
They're going to pick
up
on this.
It's funny. Like,
as they get through all the Great American Bash shit.
Well, it's crazy to think that here's this website, Pitchfork. Like, talk about a changing of the guard. You know, it's like a website that people didn't even really take seriously when it first came out. So this kid, Ryan Schreiber, did it like in place of a zine, but he like stuck with it and now built it to the point that that's the most influential music site in the world.
Wow.
Like it is everyone, not everyone reads it, but everyone that writes about music reads it. And it, like, even if they rebel against the opinions, they're still being influenced by it.
It's like the Observer of the music world, isn't it?
I think Billboard, I think the Observer fills like so many roles, you know, like the Observer, like it's almost like the WWE. I don't know. It's not even like it's so hard to put it into perspective what it would be, but like the Observer, I think is like, it's very insidery, but also it brings outsiders inside.
Yeah, I think so.
Whereas Pitchfork, I think, is more just about, not so much about the business side of what's going on behind the scenes. Because I don't even think, you know, people really know what's happening behind the scenes right now in music. Like how much money is coming from different places for different bands. And, you know, that goes for the festivals too that are taking money and the labels are taking. Everyone's got, there's a lot of money going around right now.
Are you ever
going
to write a book?
I don't really know if I have.
You worked with Sam Sutherland quite a bit.
He interviewed me.
Oh, okay.
That was all Sam's research. Like, Sam wrote the book that I'd want to write, you know?
Right.
Like, he wrote about the stuff that I'm interested in. And that's what I'd love to do at radio shows, because that's what I want to do, is, like, I love the minutiae of music and stuff and talking about it, but I don't have the wherewithal to sit down and write it.
Right.
You know? So I like talking about it more than actually putting pen to paper.
Well, there you go, everyone. Go on over to nowtoronto.com. Vote for Fucked Up.
Vote for who you want to vote for. If you're a Bruce Peninsula fan, don't let John Pollock force you to vote for me.
If you don't vote for him, don't ever download this show again.
If you don't vote for me, Agnew's going to never let you call in again.
Well, we are awaiting now your musical selection to get us on out of here, Damien.
Oh, man, 99.
You set the standards pretty high. This is June of 99.
So I was going to say, this part's always like the trickiest part of the Review Away podcast as a listener, because sometimes I love what you guys play.
And sometimes you hate
sometimes
it.
Sometimes I'm not a fan of what gets played. So it's always
well,
like
this is your redemption.
It's always like on my podcast app. It's always got that semicircle because I've had to cut off the last 2 minutes or something because it's a song. Oh, man, 99. Well, oh, 99 is it's a good year.
Mambo number five was in stride.
I think Sabu by Anti-Scene came out this year. Have I played that on the show before?
I don't think so.
Sabu by Anti-Scene.
That's a new one for sure.
Yeah, Homicidal, Suicidal, Genocidal, Sabu.
All right.
Anti-Scene from Charlotte, North Carolina, one of the greatest bands of all time. And this is like towards the end, I guess, of their initial run.
Anti-Scene is taking us out. Go on over to liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to this very podcast. Subscribing to Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes, all that other great stuff. Follow him at Left for Damien, at I Am John Pollock. Thanks for tuning in. This has been a fun trip chatting the great American Bash.
Sabu, not Sabu, as I said earlier.
Holy fuck, that's easily.
Holy shit.
3 hours
plus. My wife is calling getting free to break your neck. You're the notorious one. Leave them the zombies still have won. Respect. Our way is the only way. Hesitate, he'll make you pay. My man, the man, hostile city. Go to prison, show no pity. On his cell, suicidal.
Shittiest town in America, Baltimore!